morning, everybody. Matt Favola here with you on 720 WGN. It's 1:10 in the morning. We're live in the Skyline Studios, overlooking the river and Columbus Avenue and all that good stuff. Hello, Roger Badish.
Hello, Matt Bubala.
What's going on with you this morning?
Not a lot. Just keeping an eye on all the news that's going on in the world and trying to keep track of everything.
One thing you just mentioned was possible river flooding. What the heck's going on there? I feel like I understand that when we have lots of rain within a week, but we haven't had that much lately.
Well, apparently other places have gotten it, and according to the recent advisory that I've had, and this is from last night until 1 o'clock Saturday afternoon for Winnebago County, that's flood advisories. We also have it coming up, a flood warning for Cook County till 7 o'clock tonight, Lake County, various parts of Lake County. There's different sections along the river, Kane and McHenry counties. This is all through the beginning of the week and later in the week as we continue to get rains. If you will give me a chance to pull up one page that I need to read from for you, if I may. I'll click on that, and then, because it's the internet, I click on that. So here is the flood warning until, Des Plaines River at Lincolnshire. This is in Lake County, near Russell, near Gurnee, in Cook County, Des Plaines River near Des Plaines, Fox River, Algonquin, Lock and Dam, tailwater affecting Kane and McHenry, and Fox River at Montgomery affecting Kane and Kendall counties. Des Plaines River near Des Plaines or from Palatine Road and Prospect Heights downstream to Irving Park Road in Chicago until Saturday evening. At 7:45 p.m. Friday, the stage was at 15.5 feet. Flood stage is 15 feet. So it's already above flood stage.
I want to say I heard on the Steve Cochran show earlier this week that the lake is so high right now,
yes,
that people are, like, boats are having problems because they're not seeing things that mm-hmm. would normally stop them from traveling places because it's above water.
Exactly.
Water's above.
Right. It's a lot higher than it has been in a long time, and a number of beaches have been obliterated because the water is just so high. There's no beach anymore, and there is flooding for those structures that are right along or were right along the lake. Those structures are now starting to see water seeping in to the lower levels.
Yeah.
So it's very bad out there. And if you think we've got it bad, you see what's happening in Texas. There was one hotel that I looked, and if you know hotel hallways, you know, halfway up there's like a some molding, and then above that there's like wallpaper or whatever.
Sure.
Right. So the water was up to the molding.
Where's this at in Texas?
You know, I saw the picture this afternoon around 2 o'clock, so I can't say for sure exactly where it is, but again, I do remember that it was pictures from Texas. They're saying that it's worse than the last storm they had when they got flooded out.
Yeah, they were comparing it to Hurricane Harvey, right?
Right.
Yeah, and so this is down in the same area. Is this from that tropical depression?
Yeah.
And that's just a tropical storm, right?
Well, if you look at where all these storms are, tropical storms and hurricanes, or there are three along Mexico and the lower West Coast, Baja California.
There's three right now?
Yeah. There's three forming there.
Oh.
And there's one in the Gulf, and then there's a couple over, like, heading towards Bermuda again. It's very active season out there, very active hurricane
season.
Which
is fascinating because on the Atlantic side, we've had very little. We had the one hurricane pretty much, right?
Well, another one passed through. Humberto just passed through, and nothing. It was too far out away from Florida.
Mm-hmm.
To really cause a lot of damage, but they did get some outer winds, and that went up the coast. But again, it was farther out at sea or ocean.
But if
there's more coming up.
If you use the Sharpie, it could have hit a much wider spot.
Don't start with me. Don't start with me now.
All right, here's the important question. Jess wants to know what you want on pizza tonight.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm buying pizza tonight.
No, you said you were...
Well, I've eaten pizza the last few weeks, and I've still been losing weight, and I purposely ate very little dinner tonight, knowing that I had to build this in.
Okay. Well, you're getting
good
at this.
So now I'm starving.
Now you're starving?
Yes.
Pepperoni, please.
All right. So half with pepperoni, Jess, and half just cheese.
In celebration of Pepperoni Pizza Day from, I think, 2 days ago.
You know, you post like 5 days that it is every single day. You could name whatever you want, and every day there's I mean, last week
it was National
Pizza Day. Now it's National Pepperoni Pizza Day.
Yeah.
Is next week National Sausage, the National Mushroom.
I mean,
we could go through all the toppings.
Yeah. Why not?
I don't know.
It's pizza.
I guess.
I looked on the list. I only try to retweet days or celebrations that involve food. If you've noticed, there's kind of a trend.
I did not notice that.
Yeah. I try to only do food. So
if you did everything else, you could just do it all day long, probably.
You know, there's a list for today that's about 15 different celebrate. Seriously. In fact, one of them, I forgot what the thing was, but it's the international, the national, and the plain of the same thing. So it's like three celebrations for the same thing.
Well, it's good that they covered all the bases.
Yeah.
Yes, right?
Yeah. But it's always fun looking at that stuff.
Is it?
Yeah, I like it.
Seems like a lot of pressure on you.
No.
Keep getting those things out.
No.
No?
After about 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon, boom, boom, done.
Boom, boom, done.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Well, I'm glad to hear it.
How's by you? Anything exciting?
Anything exciting. It's going to be a busy weekend in the Bubala household.
Oh.
Anna's 8th grade volleyball team is in a tournament. They lost the opener on Thursday night. Got kind of crushed in both games. And so now they're in the loser's bracket. And that starts at 8 a.m. this morning.
You'll be wide awake.
I will not be attending the first game.
Oh,
no. I'm not doing that. The question is, will I see any volleyball tomorrow? Or will they? Because if they can start winning, they'll play like all day long. Now it's winning, it's double elimination, so next time they lose, they're done. But they play at 8. If they win at 8, they play at 9:50. So I'll try to make it out to that one if necessary, as they say. So that could be going on all day. Michael is umpiring 3 baseball games.
Wow.
Do you know what? He's going to make...
Fall league?
He's going to make $120 umpiring tomorrow.
Wait a minute, does he need help?
I know, right?
Yeah.
And then Tommy's going to work in the concession stand all day. So,
oh, good.
So the Bubalas are out there getting it done.
You taught them right.
Half pepperoni, Jess. Half pepperoni, half cheese. Sorry to interrupt everybody.
No.
Just had an important pizza question.
Very important.
Yes. You have to get that right. So we got all that going on. And then, let's see. We've got Northwestern playing at kickoff at 11?
Kickoff at 11, yeah.
And Big N, what's the name of our fancy new show?
Oh, it's not on there this time. It was only on for the first 10 games.
We're not doing the end zone?
No.
I thought this was a new weekly thing.
I thought it was too. Apparently, it was just for the first home game.
Why do they do this?
I don't know.
You're all excited about something.
I know.
And then it goes away.
So, well, you want to go out to the parking lot? I'll meet you out there. There's a great hot dog stand right across the street.
I've heard, and I've never stopped it. It's not Pink's. What's it called? You remember?
Now I forgot. I should remember. I used to live over there.
You should.
I apologize.
I've always heard it's famous hot dog stand,
yes,
but whenever
it's really small.
There's a million people, so I...
Yeah, well, it's really small inside. Yeah. It can only handle about 10 people inside.
Yeah, so I don't do that. But I'll try that sometime.
But it's really good.
But Northwestern's got Michigan State coming to town, so that's going to be a tough game. And then my Nebraska Cornhuskers, because Jack goes to Nebraska now, they are playing in Illinois tomorrow night. They're in Champaign tonight, I should say.
Mustard's Last Stand.
Mustard's Last Stand.
I should have remembered that. I apologize.
So we've got that going on.
Yeah. You're going to be busy.
Fun sporting weekend.
Yeah. And there's a golf tournament, believe it or not.
Well, there's always a golf tournament.
Well, not always.
No?
But the season ended with the FedEx Cup. And a new season has started. But all of the, like, really top golfers who can win very easily don't go out. They take time off.
Right.
They're not at these early tournaments.
Okay.
You're seeing a lot of the young talent that have just turned pro and are out trying to get some FedEx Cup points early on before the real pros come in and start taking everything.
Interesting.
Yeah. There's some good golfers out there. There's a 17-year-old just turned pro from India.
Who already turned pro?
He just turned pro. Wow. This is his first pro tournament.
Okay.
17 years old.
Ought to be young.
Yeah. have to look up the definition of that word. I forgot.
Young, I know. Tell me about it. Tell me about it. I am such a mess. Like, my shoulder, my left shoulder, you know, I hurt it a while back, and it had been fine, but now I'm, like, having trouble lifting it. And then my stupid knee, the one I just had surgery on before Christmas last year, mm-hmm. is acting up, and I can barely walk right now. I don't know what's going on. I walked on the treadmill for an hour today.
Okay.
Seemed fine, and then I'm cleaning bathrooms. And suddenly, I don't know what I did, and my knee has been killing me.
Wait a minute. You were cleaning bed. Were you down on your knees cleaning?
I might have.
Were you kneeling down for a while?
I might have kneeled down for a minute or two.
And then tried to get back up?
I don't know.
You pushed up on that knee, I'll bet you.
No, I don't think so, Rob.
You don't use a soft pad underneath your knees when you're kneeling down, do you?
I need to do that.
You have to.
You're at that age, you have to.
Yes.
But that's the thing, is like every and now, so I just had surgery on this knee, and
right.
now it hurts. Is there usually like a, you know, a year-long warranty on a knee when you have a surgery? How does that work?
No.
There's no money-back guarantee or anything?
Mm-mm. Well, Bridget had her hip done 2 years ago now.
Yeah.
And for the last year, it's been killing her. And now she... Her other knee, the one that wasn't worked on,
right.
was really hurting her. And so she went into thinking this summer we were going to have it get it done
right.
in order to go to Disney World next year. And she went and saw her old knee doctor, who had done the other one many years ago, and he said, you know what, I need to see new x-rays of your hip. He's thinking that something's happening in the hip that was redone that's causing the problem with the knee, causing the pain. She's in a lot of pain now from the hip, but now she, because of the shoulder, we've had to put that on the back burner.
Yeah.
So now she's driving. Knock on wood. She's back driving.
It is hell getting old.
Yeah.
I mean, it is.
And you're still a young whippersnapper.
Well, I'd like to think so, but sometimes I think, not so much. It's brutal. So anyways, I think I'm going to have to call my doctor next week.
And I have to check it out.
To get to the knee, I had to go through my regular doctor. But now that I had the surgery, can I just call the knee guy and say, hey, I need to
call
the
Oh, you mean as guy? Far as an insurance plan goes?
I don't know.
Yeah, no, because he's already been referred.
So he's already in.
He should be.
He already surgered me once. I can go see him now?
Well, weren't you seeing him afterwards for checkups?
I think just one. And then he said, hey, if it's fine, it's fine.
Then go see him again. He did the work. He needs to...
He needs to stand by his work.
That's right.
It's like getting a muffler, man. There's a lifetime warranty on these things. Maybe he used bad parts. What do I know?
Maybe he didn't tie everything together.
Maybe he didn't. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he wasn't a Boy Scout. He didn't know how to make a good knot.
There you go. Left out a few rivets.
Yeah. Who knows what happened?
Maybe you're going to walk around with an oil can, Tin Man.
It's not funny, Roger.
I know. I'm sorry.
Hurting.
I know all about it. It's fine.
What are you going to do?
You got to live. Hey, you know what?
It's funny, though, because there's a really good comedian, Brian Regan. I don't know if you've ever watched
him. Yeah, I've seen him.
But
it's been a while. But.
He's got a bit where he talks about how you get to an age where you wake up
mm-hmm.
and then something is wrong and you like start walking and you're like, well, I guess this is how I walk now.
Mm-hmm.
And you just kind of accept things as
right.
they seem to go wrong. You know, and this knee's been hurting for a little while. This my left shoulder. I had my right shoulder done, I don't know, 7 years ago now.
Okay.
The left one, I definitely hurt, but I've just been like, it's not that bad. But now this week, it started really acting up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's hard to sleep on it. Like, I got to face the other way now.
Right.
And it gets finally to a point where you're like, because you do it like, it's fine, whatever.
Mm-hmm. You learn to live with it.
You learn to live with it. And I don't know why we do that, because it probably shouldn't be how life goes. And my knee tonight was to the point where I'm like, I can't just live like this. I have to actually, if this doesn't get better this weekend, I got to call somebody.
Right.
And it's just, I don't know if that's generally how we all are, or if
when I think it
hurts,
it is.
We should go, okay, that hurts.
Mm-hmm.
Life shouldn't be a constant pain. Go get it checked out.
Yeah. Well, I think also because maybe in this insurance age, that we're afraid that it won't get covered. We're afraid we can't afford it. We're afraid it'll turn into something bigger. We're afraid we will be inconvenienced. We're afraid that we'll get hooked on drugs. I think this is an age when we're afraid of a lot of stuff that maybe we wouldn't have been afraid, you know, 50 years ago.
My number one fan has texted in.
Uh-oh.
He was down kissing ass, and he hurt his back while getting up. Listen, hope your knee gets better and your back gets better, but I wish you get laryngitis for the next year. I'm here all night. Wow. Hanson's texting us on the way home. Thank you, 815, for checking in. If you're not operating heavy machinery. 773 says, I had surgery on my... He's here to make me feel better now. 773, I had surgery on my right knee, but by using my other leg so much to compensate, now my left knee hurts and I have arthritis in both my knees and both my hips hurts because I have sciatica and I have deformed right foot and severe arthritis and a fracture in my other right foot.
Okay. So you, come on, Kubala.
You've got me beaten.
Yeah. You think you got it bad, bucko.
I guess it could always be worse.
Oh, yes, it could.
Life could be much more miserable than it is right now.
Jesus.
Don't you worry.
A very uplifting show, ladies and gentlemen. If you came to pick up your spirits, yes, this is the place to do it.
Hear about people that are having trouble with all of their bodily parts. John Williams will come in and tell us how to get rid of that knee pain.
There you go.
Okay, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to take our commercial break. We're going to do our news, which
yes,
is important.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to check in at Area 51. Today, Friday was the day, right? They're supposed
to.
Yeah,
I've seen
51.
Some video.
You can't shoot us all was the motto.
Mm-hmm.
Did they shoot them all? Because I bet they could if they had to.
I think they were probably laughing too hard.
Now, a bunch of people showed up, but nobody tried to actually storm the gates?
I've seen. No,
we'll
no.
We'll find out. Or maybe no. They just released an alien just to appease everybody. That's what they should have
done. Everybody looked like they were an alien.
They should have just come to the gates, whole, you know, like pushing a gurney with a sheet over it and said, all right, we don't want you all coming in, so we're going to bring him out.
Mm-hmm.
And then they should have brought out a sheet, a gurney on it with a sheet.
Right.
Like they're going to show us the body. And then when they pulled it back, somebody in a suit just jumps up to like freak them all out.
Yeah.
That would have been great. The government has no sense of humor. It's unfortunate. Okay.
Right. I'm just,
Roger,
I just,
no reaction to that.
I'm just, yeah, you know.
No, it's too late now. 312-981-7200 is the number. We got news next, and then we'll check in on those aliens on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you here on 720 WGN. There were two UFO festivals planned for this weekend out by Area 51. Of course, that Storm Area 51 craziness that went on. Somebody started a Facebook thing. Come on, wall storm Area 51. They can't shoot us all. And then like millions of people said they would attend. And then the guy who created it said, well, I was just kidding. I don't want people getting shot, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that's all supposed to be going on right now this weekend. Mick Akers is a reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal, and he's been covering what's going on out there. Good morning, Mick.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Thank you very much for jumping on with us. So I'm guessing nobody did get shot by the government today storming Area 51.
No, you know, some guys, you know, we're up there at about 3 a.m. This morning, so about 100 people showed up. Not really anything crazy. People were kind of just taking selfies, kind of acting a fool, making some chants, had some signs, had some pretty cool costumes like astronauts and aliens and stuff like that.
Sure.
Cops are kind of joking around with them about it. Some of them kind of joked around about storming. One guy touched the fence and got yelled at. So once that happened, they all kind of got the message, hey, this is kind of serious. So maybe we just kind of, you know our role and just act like, you know, we came here just to have a good time, just like the festival is going around in the area here.
Did the government seem to have an extra presence in case there was some sort of disturbance this year, since there was the idea of storming written on a site that a lot of people responded to?
Yeah, so just besides the sheriff's deputies, they're out in front of the gate. There's about a dozen of those. Just at 3, that was the time when they said that September 20th at 3 a.m. they would come and storm the gates. Right when 3 was rolling around, you saw some lights from inside the gate start moving through, and then an officer started walking through from the other gate, from inside the gate with a guard dog. So, you know, kind of, you know, beefing up the president, saying, hey, if you guys want to run through here, this dog's going to come and get you.
Yeah. What is, you know, is the whole Area 51 thing for you living out there, is it more of just a fun tourist attraction, or do people take it seriously that the government is withholding some secrets still out there?
Well, you know, it's half and half. We got tour companies that take people out there to show them the gate, kind of the mysterious gate everyone wants to see. But then you have the believers, you know, Art Bell, famous radio guy who passed away last year. He was a big UFO believer. He lived in Nye County, which was just outside of Las Vegas. So, you know, he kind of stirred up a lot of that mysterious, you know, conspiracy theories and all that stuff. So, you know, a lot of people in the area kind of followed him. And so, you know, like I said, it's about half and half. Some people actually believe. Some people just want to go and look at it because, you know, there's just so much hoopla around it. You might as well check it out while you can, you know, just because it's there.
Is it a good tourist event, though, for the local businesses in the area? Is it you know, very popular? Do a decent amount of people? I know there's these festivals every year. Is it well attended? Do a lot of people generally come out for them?
Well, this is the first year that they actually had any kind of festivals tied to anything.
Oh,
with their
really? Oh, I assume that just, there were festivals every year.
No, just because the Maddie Roberts Facebook post got all that thing going. So, like, these two events spawned off that. This one I'm at is Alien Stock. It's in Rachel, Nevada. It's about 150 miles away from Las Vegas, basically in the middle of nowhere, a bunch of dirt flying everywhere. So I don't know if you're still here right now. This band's still going on right now. It's about 11:30 our time.
See, this is interesting. So the story I had today said that Alien Stock is embroiled in a legal battle and was canceled last week, according to the event website. But that's not true? It's still going on, or what happened there?
No, it's been going on since Thursday. The name is in question. So Maddie Roberts said, hey, I own this trademark. And then Connie West from the Little Alien Inn here, Rachel, said, no, I own it. Because at first they went kind of a partnership and they were going to, you know, host it out here. Then Maddie left here and went to downtown Las Vegas with a Bud Light sponsored event. So people think, you know, maybe he got a plus check or something like that to go over there. So they're kind of in a trademark battle. But when I looked it up, some guy in Pittsburgh owns the trademark, so I didn't even know what the big deal was because neither of them even has the trademark to it.
Interesting. So there's competing events going on, but the one in Rachel and then the other one's in Vegas, so they're not even near each other.
Well, there's the Vegas one kind of popped at last minute, but there's another one in Hyco, Nevada, which is 40 minutes from here, from Rachel, Nevada. So we're both in Lincoln County, very rural towns. Basically, the only thing out here is the Little Alien here. And Hyco is the Alien Research Center, which is a gift shop with a bunch of alien-themed stuff, from vodka to, you know, a magnet of alien-themed. So they're having their own little thing. Paul Oakenfold, the DJ, was there today. Arby set up a booth with some specialty items. I heard that one wasn't very well attended from my colleagues. I heard maybe about 200 or 300 people, so I don't think they got the crowd they were looking for.
Yeah.
This one here has about 3,000, but it's over 30 acres, and people are parking and camping all over the place, so it's kind of spread out. So if you see some pictures, it might not look like as well attended, but, you know, once you kind of walk around the site and see all the people, it's pretty well attended.
And so I'm reading in the story that Rachel, Nevada, only has one commercial establishment, the Little LA Inn, which is owned by Connie, who you mentioned. So all these people that suddenly come to this area that's not really an area, what are they doing? Like, are they buying food? Like, how are they buying food? How are they surviving? Are they all just sleeping in their cars mostly?
Well, Connie's team, mostly of her family and some of their friends, basically worked for 6 weeks straight, and they plowed like 30 acres of land, made it flat, tried to do the best they can with dust control, made areas for RV parking, camping, and then regular parking. And then they have a whole festival ground with three different stages, food trucks, vendors, kinds of stuff. And then so everyone's kind of just doing their own thing here. And then across the street is nothing to do with this at all. But a lot of people just kind of set their own camps up over there. So there's about maybe 70 to 80 vehicles just across the street alone. So everyone kind of just kind of took it in their own hands, but everyone kind of meets up in the middle and just has a good time.
And is Connie West going to make some money out of this? Is she charging an admission, or is it just based on whatever they're selling there?
There's no admission for the event itself, but if you're parking or camping on her site, yeah, there is a price. Mm-hmm. I think it was about $140 for an RV and $60 if you're going to car camp. And then they're charging media if they wanted to park right behind the stage, like $1,000 for their spot.
Wow.
Luckily, my organization was smart enough not to pay that, so we just did the regular $140 spot. But I did see like 6 or 7 satellite trucks over there, so at least they made us about $7,000 off them.
Yeah, so she's doing okay this weekend.
Yeah, I would assume, you know, she's gonna make out pretty well. It was a lot of work for her to put in and get all these permits and, you know, kind of get all these people in, security, all that, you know, EMT services and all that. But I think once it's all said and done, that, you know, she's going to come out in a positive. But she's really stressed out. She says Monday she's heading out of town. She's heading to Kansas. She's basically going to take like 2 or 3 weeks off and just hang out at her house over there. She bought a house over there by a lake.
Run away for a little while, huh? Well, interesting.
Yeah, get away from this town. Obviously, this town has like 47 people population, and, you know, with 3,000 people in Flushing it, it's like, you know, it's a pretty big deal for them.
Yeah, it's got to be crazy. Has she said with how many people did actually show up and what she's been able to charge? Will she try to do this again next year?
She keeps, like, beating around the bush on that. She's, you know, with all the issues and all the stuff that came with this one, she's like, I don't know about next year. But then a lot of people are like, well, come on, Connie, you got to do it. You know, a lot of people are kind of like joining together, volunteering, helping each other out whatever they can. So it's kind of like promoting like a community vibe here.
Yeah.
So she seems kind of keen to it. I think if she has a little bit more time than about 6 weeks to plan it, which she had this time, I think she'll do a little bit better. So I think once she goes on her vacation and kind of calms her nerves down, she might think about, you know, doing this every year.
And maybe sees what ends up in the bank account at the end. I would imagine that will be a factor as well.
Well, you know, the money always talks, but she's been pretty happy this weekend, so I think she might be already counting those dollars.
Yeah, no kidding. Hey, real quick, jumping to another topic, since you're out there in the Vegas area, how is the Raiders Stadium coming along? Is that going to be all ready for next season?
Yeah, that thing's coming up real quick. They're starting to throw the glass on it already. The roof's about to go up. They're putting the steel cable to hold the roof up. Should be done by the middle of next month. And then they'll put the roof on about three quarters of the way, leave a little spot open until March just for some interior work. Some of the interior work's already going on now. A lot of bathrooms are getting in there. They're working on, they're going to have a retractable field because UNLV football is going to play on an artificial turf. The Raiders playing on a real grass turf. So it's going to move out and, you know, catch the sun rays when they're not playing. UNLV plays on the artificial. On game day, they'll move in, and the Raiders will play on that. A lot of people are kind of doubting that they can get it done this quick, but, you know, every day I drive by heading to the office, and it seems like every day I drive by, something new is going up. But, yeah, this thing, you know, it's going up, and it's going to be ready to go.
So it will be a fully enclosed stadium.
Yeah, not a retractable roof, but it'll have a wall that opens up facing the strip. So, you know, everyone loves looking at the strip. So, say Monday Night Football, those doors open up, and there's a view of, you know, Las Vegas Strip right there.
Yeah.
With the Al Davis flame, you know, kind of just right there in the foreground, it'll make for, you know, a pretty cool sight.
Last time I was out there, if people haven't been to Vegas in a while, just to the west of the strip is an expressway or a freeway, and then the stadium is right on the other side of that. Will it be easy for people to get from the strip over to the stadium? Is there going to be a walkway or pathways over if people are staying? Because there's a lot of hotels that are in walking distance of that stadium. But last time I was out there, I didn't quite see how they plan on all the people getting from the strip over to the stadium.
Yeah, so they're looking at just using an existing road at Hacienda, which runs between the Mandalay Bay and the Luxor.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to put about $1.1 million into upgrading it because they said they're going to have some kind of, you know, enhanced features for game days for, you know, not tailgating, obviously, but, you know, some events on there.
Mm-hmm.
The MGM just announced that they're going to let people park on the site where we had the Route 91 shooting.
Oh, wow.
So that's right across the street from Mandalay Bay, obviously.
Yeah. So
it kind of sparked a little bit, you know, outcry for some people saying, hey, I don't think that's the best use of it. But in the end, they're going to have, like, some parking, a community center to bring some youth sports, and then some kind of memorial for the shooting. But, so it looks like, you know, they want to use the parking garages, some of those MGM properties, Luxor, Mandalay Bay, and then Excalibur and the MGM across the street from there. They're trying to get the monorail to run over there. It stops right now at the MGM Grand. Mm-hmm. But the company's looking at some financial issues, and they got denied some tax-exempt bonds from the state. So I don't think the monorail is going to make it out that way. So it's going to look like, yeah, you're going to have to kind of truck it from at least MGM if you get off there, or stay at Mandalay Bay or park over there.
But it will be easy enough to walk over. There will be a road that goes over the expressway that pedestrians will be able to use easily enough.
Yeah, they'll close it down to vehicle traffic on game days, and you know, perfectly safe for pedestrians.
Okay, is the town excited about football coming? Or are they kind of non-committal to it? I mean, the hockey was embraced really well, surprisingly well, in Nevada or in Las Vegas. Do you think that the football will be embraced by the locals, or will be, because that's, you know, hockey and football are two different things. That football stadium, I'm guessing, is going to hold 65,000-70,000 people versus the 20,000 you want for a hockey game. So is it going to be as easy to fill a stadium for football as it has been for them at the hockey games?
Going off the PSL and the season ticket sales, they're about 95% right now. So, you know, they're almost there right now. Yeah. A lot of it, you know, I think it's going to be based on bringing in some people from out of state. Say, hey, I live in Minnesota and it's cold here. On a fly down to Vegas and check the Vikings play the Raiders.
Yeah.
They're looking at maybe 70-30 locals versus, you know, outsider fans. So obviously Vegas is already a big tourist attraction. So I think adding the stadium is just one more thing to bring people here.
Yeah, when they're playing the Giants or the Jets or the Bears or all these cold weather teams, you know, in the fall, I imagine there's going to be a lot of people that are willing to come out for a weekend game.
Oh, yeah, I've already, you know, people have been reaching out and saying, hey, I can't wait to get out there and check this new stadium out. Even Southern California, even though, you know, they'll be probably rooting for the Raiders, they're going to be, you know, driving out from the L.A., San Diego areas, even flying from Oakland. You know, it's a quick, you know, that's a 90-minute trip on a plane. So, obviously, you know, not too hard to get these California fans. They already have a, you know, long-standing relationship with the team. So, yeah, I don't think there'll be any kind of issue filling the stadium up here.
Yeah, and it'll help if they're actually good, you know, by the time they're playing there. What about a Super Bowl? Is that stadium being built large enough? I imagine that's something that Las Vegas would love to attract is a Super Bowl. Do you see that in the near future?
Yeah, so for, you know, just a regular game day, it's about 65,000 capacity. They can expand it up to 72,000 with the Super Bowl ready. And it looks like the earliest we can get that is 2025. And it seems like from everybody I've been talking to, they're pretty confident that one's going to be coming here. So I think they'll probably announce that sometime, I think somewhere around the beginning of the year, some NFL meetings go on there and they kind of pick and choose the Super Bowls there.
Yeah.
But just talking to some Raiders people, it seems like they're pretty positive that that's the year that's going to be coming here.
Interesting. It's so fascinating to think about how all the major sports used to shun Las Vegas, and we can't go out there and we can't do things out there because of the gambling. And now with the legalization nationwide, everybody's jumping in and fully on board. How has that affected Las Vegas? Is when you look at the legalized sports gambling nationwide, is that frightening the casinos, or is it making them feel like more people will start gambling recreationally and that'll bring more people out here to the sports books and things like that?
Yeah, everyone's kind of looking at it as a positive. Like you said, it used to be like, hey, that's something you shouldn't do, don't gamble. But now it's, you know, it's kind of catching on across the nation. So more people, you know, coming down to Las Vegas, like you can kind of compare some of our sports books to someone saying like Pennsylvania. And, you know, Las Vegas has the best ones in the world.
Sure.
So it's kind of like, hey, you want to come see, like, the best of the best come down here. Gaming numbers have been up ever since all that's gone on. Sports betting has been up. So I haven't seen any kind of adverse issues going on here since all these legalizations have been going on. So it's, you know, it's been a good thing for Las Vegas.
Excellent. Mick Akers is a reporter at the Las Vegas Review-Journal. You can follow him on Twitter at Mick Akers. Thank you so much for checking in from Area 51. Are you going to go now hang out with the band? Are we doing like some weird like neon green shots that's a special alien shot? What's the party now tonight?
You know, I've been up since 2 o'clock yesterday storming the gate. About 18 hours in, I'm about ready to go to bed.
All right. Well, don't get abducted tonight. You know how it usually happens. You wake up tomorrow feeling weird, and you'll realize what happened. So just make sure you stay safe and lock the door.
Hey, I will. Thanks a lot.
Hi, Mick. Thanks so much. We appreciate it. Mick Akers at the Las Vegas Review-Journal in Nevada. We've got the stories that matter from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom coming up in a few minutes with Roger Badish here on 720 WGN. Hello, everybody. We got the news coming up here in just a couple of minutes. Roger, at the beginning of the show, I was whining about my life and my knees and my shoulders.
And yeah, What?
Mom checked in.
Uh-oh.
And leave it to mom to, you know,
put things in perspective.
I guess, you know, sometimes moms are chicken soup and hugs and kisses and back scratches and make you feel better. And sometimes moms are a cold glass of water in the face.
Yeah.
Mom writes, TV ads for different meds tell you all the side effects of those drugs. You are now starting to get the side effects of living. No sense in complaining because it's going to get worse. Thank you, mother.
Good one, mom.
Yeah.
Because I could be your... I mean, I'm old enough to be your parent.
Yes, you are.
So, I mean, you know, I'm being nice.
You are being nice. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Mom's far enough away.
I'm leaving all the rough stuff up to mom.
Smack me. Yep.
Yep,
that's okay.
I know. You can take it.
I can.
It hurts, but you can take it.
Yeah. The truth hurts. It does. Especially as we're getting older.
Yep.
So an SUV drives through the mall. Now
Woodfield Mall.
The latest I saw on this was about 5 o'clock this afternoon after that god-awful Cubs game. I was watching the news, and Chuck Gowdy, intrepid reporter for ABC 7, had spoken. The latest they had, the police hadn't really said anything yet, but a suspect was in custody. And of course, it was the guy. They took him out of the car. But but it's so funny. He's a suspect. So you have him on video. You took him out of the car. He's only a suspect. We're not sure.
Right.
You know, we got the guy is what you got. And Chuck had talked to the guy's dad. He's a 23-year-old from, I think, Palatine. And the dad had told Chuck, I'm on the way to the police station with my son's meds. So it made it sound like something like might have been off his meds. Maybe this is something weird. Nobody was directly hurt from the SUV. So there were some minor injuries from fleeing because everybody was freaking out, of course. Right. But he didn't hit anybody. Have we heard anything more today on what's going on?
No.
It's a crazy scene when you see the videos from it. This guy driving around. And when I first heard about it, I wondered, okay, because you just heard that this happened. So I'm thinking, okay, did somebody start a car? Because, you know, they have those display cars often in malls.
Sure, but they don't leave the keys in there.
No, but somebody might know how to hotwire or something and just start joyriding around in a car. I didn't know that somebody actually just plowed through the doors and went on in and cut through.
Yeah, plowed through the doors at Sears, drove through Sears first, and then into the mall.
Yeah, and then start driving around in the mall.
Right.
Through the kiosks.
Yeah.
What did you think of when you first saw that video? Because one thing very specifically comes to my mind.
Well, I was hoping no one got hurt.
Sure, but what did it remind you of?
Oh, the Blues Brothers.
The Blues Brothers,
yeah,
absolutely.
Everybody in the world was thinking the same thing.
The new Oldsmobile.
Yeah.
It was totally a scene from the Blues Brothers. Jess, you said you had a friend who was actually in the mall at the time?
Yeah, one of my coworkers. So she works part-time for our organization.
Okay.
But she has a couple little ones, like her oldest is 5, and so they were at the mall this afternoon, and they were exiting out through Sears, like...
Right near that exit?
Yeah.
So, and then a minute later it happened, or what?
Well, she was already into the parking lot going to her car, and then, I don't know, right after that it happened.
Wow.
Within, like, seconds.
I mean, that would be scary if you had kids. Because you see this video, like a lot of people whipping out their cell phones, and the one cell phone video I saw, somebody like sort of following the car, like feeling all brave, like I'm going to follow this, see what this is, I'm videotaping, and then you see the SUV go into reverse, you see the white lights come on, and the person videotaping starts running backwards like, oh, wait a minute, I don't know what's going to happen here, I better get out of the way. So, always interesting. Chicago Stories told 24/7 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. You heard the tone, 2:01 in the morning. Here's the news with Roger. Good morning, everybody. Matt Duval here with you. 2:06 in the morning on 720 WGN. Boy, all the news was dominated, at least a lot of it, by the whole latest issue with President Trump and the Ukraine. And the best part of it so far, I think, has been, you know, Rudy Giuliani's just always a treat. He's just so much fun. He's just so energetic. And
he's got a lot of energy, doesn't he?
He loves going on these shows. And he loves going on CNN instead of just going to a family-friendly network to him. Just let's go on CNN and let's fight with people. Let's get it out there. And you got to love, and I know that they can spin it, and you can, because, you know, it's not as clear as everyone wants to say when he says, well, did you press them on Joe Biden? No, I didn't. And then 30 seconds later, well, yes, of course I did. And they're having a lot of fun with that, with Rudy doing the ultimate flip-flop there. Although I think he would say in the nuance of it, I think he was playing
with them.
I think that, you know, there's a lot of, we're smarter than y'all think. And we're getting you to talk about this instead of other things. And I think they do that quite a bit. And it's kind of brilliant if you want to give them credit for something. You know, they get the CNNs and MSNBCs very riled up with certain things instead of worrying about other things.
Yeah.
So there's always that.
And they've done pretty good. I mean, I've said this before. And I know there are a lot of pundits out there and a lot of people who think that the current administration has no clue what's going on. I think they have very much a clue of what's going on. I think they're very measured in their actions and what they do and when they do it and how they do it. And it makes for interesting viewing.
Well, measured is not a term I would ascribe to President Trump.
I think he
knows what he... I don't think it's measured because I think he thinks things and just does them.
But I think even that is measured.
I don't.
All right.
But I think he's got a reason, though. I think it's not all, can you believe he just did that? It's like, well, yeah, I can, because I think he knows what he's doing. I think he's, you know, getting you to think about other things, talk about other things, complain about other things. And then everybody gets all, you know, we're going to add this to the impeachment. We're going to add this to this.
Everyone gets
there
all riled
up. There is nothing. I can't imagine what President Trump would do that people would finally say, you know what, That's too much. I just don't know what that would be. I mean, he already said he could shoot somebody and get away with it, and people would still vote for him, and I don't know that he's wrong about that.
I understand what you're saying.
I don't know. Anyways, I just wanted to say that.
Okay.
We had a big high school football night here locally, too, so there's a lot of... Have you reported any high school football scores?
No, because it's another loss for the Wildcats, excuse me.
You can't even remember the name.
Yeah, it's just... I saw it very first thing, even before I got on the air, and I saw it and go, not again. It was like by 3 points. They lost by a few.
You started out with a win, and then you've lost every game since,
yeah,
right?
I know. It's just... I don't know.
Can you look up real quick Marion Central?
Yeah, give me a second here.
Marion Central was playing St. Vider last night, and a good friend of the family, Jack Mahoney, is a senior at St. Vider, and he's the quarterback. St. Vider, I think, was 2-1 going into this game. Marion Central Catholic from Woodstock, Illinois, was 3-0 and had not given up a point yet this year.
Really?
Which is stunning, because Jack went there for 4 years, and they weren't very good. But suddenly this year, they're world beaters, and I don't know if they just had a little easier competition, or if they're doing well, or what's going on. So what's your report?
This would have been a great game to watch.
Okay.
In overtime.
Wow.
St. Vider over Woodstock Marion, 28-21.
Wow.
That would have been an awesome game to watch.
Sounds like it.
Overtime, baby.
Wow. All right, there you have it.
Yeah. Any other schools you're... I used to do a handful of schools in the newscasts.
Mount Carmel
High School.
I'd be wondering I don't know if they played tonight or if they are
Saturday
night.
Not everybody plays. Yeah.
A lot of the Catholic League schools sometimes play on Saturdays, or at least I remember.
Chicago
them.
Mount Carmel played Loyola.
Ooh, that would have been a good game.
Good game, and a close one.
And?
In regulation, Mount Carmel 17, Loyola 14. Shut up.
Take that, Ramblers.
Ooh, Nutrier got clobbered.
Yeah?
31-6. Wow. Okay.
That is a clobbering.
That is. Let me see here. Evanston's was close. Frem beat him 19-15. 4 points. 19-15.
That's close as well.
Yeah. I don't know why I don't do it anymore. I used to grab a bunch of close well, Chicago
it,
area.
It can't please everybody.
Well, right, because there's hundreds of schools. I think I just did Chicago schools, like Chicago Public League schools. Or I would try to find the rankings of the top 10 and just do those scores. Mm-hmm. But if you give some, then everybody else who didn't hear theirs is going to get upset.
That's right.
Then you're so, right. And I don't know why we still, I guess for the playoffs, they do it in basketball, the Preps Plus program we used to have.
Yeah.
I don't know why we still don't do it in football.
I don't know either,
yeah,
sir.
That's all right. Maybe I could do it. Niles North got beat.
At a new
51
job.
To 29. Wow.
That's a high-scoring game.
Yeah. Marist, Brother Rice, do you care?
You know.
17-14, Brother Rice.
Over Marist?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, we've covered enough.
Okay. See, that's what I'm saying. That was...
We're there.
Yeah, okay.
We have now met our fiduciary duty to report on the high school.
There you go. Yeah.
Everybody had good weather for it, though. I mean, that was a nice
day. It was a nice day.
It was a really nice day today.
Yeah.
I needed, when I woke up from my little nap before I come down, I woke up warm upstairs. I had to turn the air conditioner on tonight before I left.
Well, it got up to about 81, 82. Well, you're a little further west. A little
yeah, it got in the
warmer.
Low 80s out there for sure.
Yeah, mid 80s easily. Yeah, we turned up. It was more the humidity along the lakefront than it was the heat. At least for me. So I made sure that the air was on.
So earlier this week, the Trump administration moved to ban flavored vaping products to discourage young people from e-cigarettes. We've been hearing in the news, suddenly in the last 3 or 4 weeks, about all these serious injuries, sometimes deaths, related to vaping. There's just not much known yet about vaping because it's so new. So there haven't been years worth of studies, things like that. That's one issue. The other issue is there's a whole black market for these vaping products. You know, the vaping, the e-cigarette came out as an idea so you're not in a smoker.
Right.
If you switch over to vaping, you're not ingesting the tar and the other, I guess, carcinogens that are in cigarettes. This would give you a fix of nicotine because there's nicotine in the juice that you that heats up and becomes vapor that you vape, that you breathe in.
Right.
And that would help you start weaning or satisfying your nicotine without all the other stuff that's in cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
What we didn't know and what's been relatively unknown is that possibly this could cause other lung problems. And that's what they're starting to find is kids having serious issues with their lungs. But the question is that from the vaping products or is that from these black market products? There's a story we're going to speak after the 2:30 news with Dr. Joel Nitzkin about this. He's works in D.C. on tobacco related issues. So we'll talk to him about the proposed ban, what that does. Are these really being marketed to kids? Is that a concern? When you hear about some of the flavors of the vape juice, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You would say, yeah, that sounds like it's being marketed towards a younger group. I imagine that the company marketing it would say, no, this is to give flavors and a deliciousness to this that would encourage people to put down the cigarettes and pick this up instead as a safer alternative.
It all depends on perspective.
New York Times has a story about the vaping situation and how serious it is in high schools. And they were actually reporting out here in Crystal Lake. The reporter, Julie Bossman, is stationed here in the Midwest. And she said that she writes, at least 530 people have been sickened by a mysterious lung illness related to using e-cigarettes with nicotine or vaping THC, the psychoactive ingredient in marijuana, and at least 8 have died. That is in high schools, the epicenters of youth vaping, racing to give teenagers a new urgent message, and that is vaping can be deadly. Federal health officials have yet to pinpoint an exact cause of the recent illnesses, but the alarming pattern has put principals and teachers into crisis mode. They're holding assemblies to warn students about the dangers. They're getting creative with rules to make it harder for students to secretly vape in school bathrooms, hallways, and even classrooms. They're trying to train parents and teachers in the wide array of vape devices, which look like pens or flash drives, and which many adults do not even recognize. During an assembly at one suburban Chicago high school this week, hundreds of students, many dressed in school colors, saw an x-ray image of a young man's lungs cloudy and damaged on an auditorium screen. He had recently been hospitalized after vaping and placed in a medically induced coma for a week, a substance abuse consultant told the students from a stage. His lungs are now that of a 70-year-old, and he's in his 20s, the consultant said. Can you imagine how that's going to affect the rest of his life? He can't run. He can't play sports. The students watched solemnly. A few squirmed in their seats. After the assembly at Crystal Lake Central High School, some students said they were skeptical that vaping was as dangerous as the presentation suggested. The students told of a high school ecosystem where vaping devices are easily obtained and refill cartridges with THC oil, known as carts, are sold for $20 a piece. It is not uncommon, these students said, for seniors to sell vape pens to freshmen eager to take up vaping. Opportunities to vape discreetly are everywhere, they said, in an empty hallway, a bathroom stall, or the back row of a classroom where a teacher cannot possibly monitor every student's move. Older students said they tended to leave campus for lunch, vaping in their cars along the way. It's rare to find someone who doesn't do it, said Alexis Padilla, 16, a junior. You can't go on social media without someone's videos of them doing it. There was later in the article, they say that I think a study said 1 in 4 high school kids are doing it. And when she was talking to students about that, they laughed and said, please, everybody is doing it. Everybody is doing it or has tried it. And it's much more serious than I ever saw it. I sent this article to my 3 teenagers at home. You know, my kids have a real aversion to smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And mom, if you're still listening, I apologize. Because my mom and my aunt smoke. And the smell of the cigarette is so strong on them when you walk into their house,
right,
or anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I have an aversion to it just because I grew up with 2 parents who smoked all the time. So it was just kind of like I've literally never tried a cigarette in my life. And I just have no intention to. And I can't imagine I ever would. And I'm hopeful. And they say in the story, you know, we as Americans, we did a really good job of getting kids off cigarettes. I mean, this teen smoking rates have been going down, going down, going mm-hmm. down. But now this new thing gets introduced, and Illinois passed a law. I believe you have to be 21 now to buy vaping products, and that's great. But nationwide, it's state to state, it's not being taken care of necessarily like that. And it sounds like more needs to be done. Of course, President Trump talked about a vaping ban on these flavors,
mm-hmm.
things like that.
Most flavors, yeah.
Most flavors, but. Some people in this article say that that's not the real issue. It's this THC stuff that people are mixing.
Exactly.
And that's not regulated because that's black market stuff.
Right. So and then they're selling it to kids. These other people are selling it to kids, and it's not the commercially available stuff. Yeah. And that's what's getting dangerous.
Yeah. Well, and the other stuff could be dangerous, too. We just don't know. There's just not enough known
right.
about it.
Yeah.
So Dr. Joel Nitzkin will join us after the news at 2:30, and we'll talk more about okay. that and find out where we're headed with that and what more can be done and needs to be done,
mm-hmm.
Et cetera, et cetera.
In fact, hold on a second. I believe 5 more young people in Illinois sue e-cigarette giant Juul, and again, J-U-U-L, not to be confused with the grocery store chain.
Not to be confused with the Juuls.
Right, the Juuls. Over nicotine addiction and health problems. This is a story went into the Chicago Tribune last night, calling out the makers of e-cigarettes for marketing tactics. They say targeted minors got them hooked on nicotine, causing health problems. The plaintiffs, all 18 and 20, all between 18 and 20 from Chicago, Crystal Lake, Lincolnwood, and downstate Pekin and Carlinville are suing Juul Labs, its parent company, Altria Group, which also owns tobacco
yeah.
giant
yeah.
Philip
oh,
Morris.
I'm sure they're all I'm sure the tobacco companies are jumping in on this.
Mm-hmm. Let's see here. Companies, there's a whole bunch of, like, the reasons why from
yeah.
the lawsuit. They even show list the kids.
Well, what I don't understand is, I'm against the teen vaping. I think they should do everything they can. I think anything marketed towards kids should be taken off. But they're saying, oh, we're addicted to nicotine now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what the hell did you think was going to happen? It's a nicotine product. Of course you're addicted to nicotine. You got yourself hooked on it. What are you going to sue the heroin dealer too? I mean, This is what happens.
Yeah.
You know, be smart enough not to do it then or quit it. But suing the company, I mean, sue the company for marketing to teenagers or whatever. But what cracks me up, oh, now I'm addicted to nicotine. Oh, really? I don't think they told you you wouldn't be. You know, you're using the product.
Well, I've never seen the product, so I don't know if there's any warnings on the packaging.
I don't know either. I do know that Juul had a huge front ad in the Tribune, a full-page ad in the Tribune earlier this week or last week. I think it was last week.
All of this, though, really predates that. All of this that we're hearing about now predates what they have done in the wake of these complaints.
Of course. Yeah, this is all. But Juul lists out that they will very strongly defend themselves that we've never marketed towards kids. We're pushing our retailers to not sell to kids under 21 and like all of these things. So they're acting like they're very much, hey, this is a product for smokers. We want smokers to use this. We don't want kids starting if they don't already smoke. They're saying all the right things and being very, you know, tough on that. But it'll be interesting to see what happens. But we've created this new category of issue for kids. And I don't know if they can, you know, put the genie back in the bottle.
Yeah.
That being said, so Juul takes out a full page ad for just a moment. You know, John Williams always writes, if you don't subscribe to your local newspaper, today's a good day.
Yep.
And I agree with that wholeheartedly. And I subscribe to the Chicago Tribune. We get 7-day a week delivery, pay through the nose for it. And I subscribe digitally to the New York Times. I love getting the Tribune. I want to have the Tribune. I will have the Tribune delivered every day until all my kids are out of the house because I want them around a newspaper and holding a newspaper. If it wasn't for the kids, I would cancel it and go digital only because it is not worthwhile to actually have the newspaper delivered to your front door anymore. It drives me, it pains me to say that because I love having it. But
we get ours delivered to the front door.
Good. But when the Cubs play a 7 o'clock game at night,
oh,
and it's
yeah.
here this time of year, and you open it up and it's go to ChicagoTribune.com to find out what happened.
The latest, you know, scores.
And I know, okay, I already know what happened, but I want the write-up of the game and the nuance and Paul Sullivan to tell me, you know, why we should be watching for this or that, and they don't have it because how the hell earlier they print in the damn paper anymore? It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
You can't even put in, you look at the standings then and it's all late games.
I wish we had papers still like we used to have.
I understand that, you know, there's a time constraint and this and that, but you can wait till midnight, you would think, to get that in.
There would be three morning editions. There would be the early morning, the mid-morning, and then the sports final.
Yeah, which is crazy to think about. That it
right.
Like.
Then there used to be an afternoon edition, which was the morning edition with a couple extra pages wrapped around with the latest news from the day.
And that was more for the commuters on the train on the way home.
Exactly.
Might have paper,
but right? It also had the latest news from the day.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have to wait till the morning to read about what you saw on TV the night before.
Yeah.
The newspapers were ahead of everyone else. So, and I enjoyed that. I used to buy the papers a number of times each day, both papers.
Well, my first job growing up was delivering the Hammond Times, as it was called back then. Now it's the Northwest Indiana Times.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hammond Times was an afternoon paper. When I started out as a kid, I would deliver the paper when I got home from school. And then Sunday mornings.
Okay.
But 5 days a week and maybe on Saturday, I don't know what. Maybe it wasn't printed on Saturday. I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But during the week, it was afternoons.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious.
Is it still afternoon? Is it morning now?
I believe it's a morning paper.
Okay.
Now, but
I used to deliver Tribs.
It's been about 40 years since I delivered it, so I'm not sure.
I delivered Tribune afternoon editions.
Yeah.
I'd get home from school. The papers would be dumped on my front porch. I'd roll them, put the rubber bands around them.
So they had home delivery of the afternoon edition?
I used to deliver the afternoon edition.
Really?
Yeah. I'd get home from school around 3:30. So I'm out on my bike at 4,
so
tossing newspapers.
That ordered the afternoon paper instead of the morning paper?
Maybe they got both. Maybe they ordered both.
Wow.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there were different plans back then.
Talk about a different landscape of the media industry. 847 text, hey, Matt and Roger, the Juul vaping device does come with warnings about nicotine being addictive and that it contains nicotine. Great show. Thank you very much, 847. Okay. All right, Dr. Joel Nitzkin, we'll talk more about this after the news, which is coming up next. On Monday, your Chicago Bears are on WGN-TV. The reigning NFC North champs battle Washington. That's Bears Redskins Monday Night Football on WGN TV. Kickoff is on Monday at 7 p.m. Dr. Joel Nitzkin is a public health physician, board certified in preventive medicine as his medical specialty. He is a senior fellow for tobacco policy at the R Street Institute. He joins us on the phone right now to talk about the latest in the vaping situation. Hey, Dr. Joel, how are you this morning?
Doing fine, and you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us. We appreciate it. We've been talking a little bit leading up to our interview here about the latest with the vaping. I was reading from a New York Times article from today and about the Trump administration and what they're looking at as far as these flavors and banning certain flavors. Let's start at the beginning with vaping. And am I right that did it really start out as a way to help cigarette smokers get their nicotine fix without all the dangers of cigarettes?
That's exactly right. That was the idea of the e-cigarette when it was first invented. It was a low-risk substitute for cigarettes, one that would not carry the extreme risks of cancer, heart disease, and lung disease.
Do we know that there are not extreme risks when it's done right? I mean, there's nicotine in there, but is there enough? Have there been studies? Have there been enough research to know what sucking in this vapor does to the lungs?
Well, we have a decade of an excellent safety record for e-cigarettes. We know that properly made e-cigarettes don't cause any kind of lung disease. As a matter of fact, for people with lung disease who start vaping e-cigarettes, their symptoms improve about the same amount they would improve if they were smoking and quit smoking.
So when we hear all of these stories of these kids and the issues that they're having, is it, as some of the articles have suggested, maybe not about the properly manufactured products, but about the black market products that people and kids are making, this vape juice with THC and other things that are not the ones sold in stores?
Well, this pneumonia is obviously due to something that's new on the illicit marketplace. It's due to a combination of THC or some type of other marijuana preparation with vitamin E. And that's what's causing this pneumonia. It's a new phenomenon. It's from a new product. It's totally illicit. And we know that that's what the cause of this pneumonia is. It has nothing to do with any of the nicotine-based e-cigarettes. But research is still continuing to figure out what in this mix is causing the marijuana. So that part is still under investigation.
So every kid that's had a medical injury or, all of these injuries or these deaths or the medically induced comas or these kids who are in their 20s and now the doctor's saying they have the lungs of a 70-year-old, all of those have been related to THC-infused vape juice that is black market made?
Every single one of them, where we have reasonably complete information, has a history of vaping this kind of a THC-related product. Now, we don't have that information on all the cases, but for all the ones we do, that's clearly the case. And there are some cases where we just don't have the information. There may be some cases where the kid didn't know what he or she was vaping.
So when we talk about the administration banning all these flavored vape juices and these things that seem like they might be more appealing to kids, is that a good idea, or is that, throwing something that's not completely unrelated to what the issue is? Or is it, well, We don't want, maybe those are starters, and then the kids graduate to the THC thing. So if we stop them from vaping in the first place, that's still a good thing.
It doesn't make a lick of sense. It really doesn't. They're basically banning and restricting the wrong product. And people should really be informed that it's this black market new THC product that is the problem. And people who have been vaping nicotine, especially those who've been vaping it as a substitute for cigarettes and a way to quit cigarettes, should continue vaping what they have been using. If you're using the same product you were using a year ago, keep using it.
Well, Dr. Nitzkin, would you disagree, though, that these things have been marketed towards kids? Do you think that the companies have erred in how they've marketed these things and that they were appealing to teenagers?
Well, there's no question that they were appealing to teenagers. The question of whether or not they were marketed to kids is another question. That question means, you know, if it's marketed to young adults, persons 21 to 35 years of age, does that mean it's being marketed to kids under 18? Well, probably not. But even though it's not being specifically marketed to this younger population, they may find it very attractive. Now, with the Juul product and Juul knockoffs, there are a number of things that just make it very attractive to almost anyone, especially kids.
Mm-hmm.
One is the bigger nicotine kick that you get from it. The second, that it's a stealth product. It's just so easy to hide. It looks like a flash drive. And it's also a stealth product because if you use it properly, there's no vapor cloud to give away the fact that you've been vaping.
That's very interesting because the New York Times article was talking about how kids hide this in school. And I think, how in the world do they hide this? Because whenever I've seen somebody vaping, I've always been stunned by the amount of, I guess it's not smoke, is that steam or whatever that is that they blow out of their mouths. It looks like a ginormous cloud. So there are ways to vape where you're not revealing that cloud that we've seen?
Well, The Juul product and the Juul knockoffs are basically designed to produce little or no cloud. But even with a traditional e-cigarette, if you wait a few seconds from the time you inhale to the time you exhale, there will be little or no cloud.
Mm. So let me make sure I understand, Dr. Nitzkin. You're defending vaping itself, that it there's a decade of it being done, and there have not been these medical problems.
I am defending vaping as a substitute for smoking.
Okay, so if you were already smoking,
that is the one legitimate reason to vape.
Okay,
if you're not a smoker, don't vape. This stuff is not risk free.
Right. What are the risks, even on the good products down the road? Just that you're putting this into your lungs, it's still a negative overall, even if you're not putting in the tar and everything else that comes in a traditional cigarette?
Well, quite frankly, the risks are theoretical for the basic nicotine e-cigarettes. Because there's the possibility that, there may be some contaminants in there. It certainly can be irritating to some people. The British have made the estimate that vaping nicotine is less than 5% the risk of cigarettes. There is the risk of becoming addicted to nicotine,
mm-hmm,
if you're not already addicted. The risks are small. We're not sure what they are. There, quite frankly, have not been significant adverse effects from the vaping of properly made and properly maintained nicotine-related vape devices. Now, if it's not properly maintained or if somebody tries putting other stuff into the vape liquid, well, all bets are off. But if you stick with the stuff from the manufacturer, the stuff that you buy at the convenience store, the drugstore, the vape shop, and you don't put in the wrong battery, you should do just fine.
Well, is that reason enough to push Juul and the other manufacturers harder to make sure that these aren't getting into the hands of kids, because in general, kids have done, we have done a good job, I think you would say, in this country of discouraging kids from smoking. The smoking rates have gone way down, right? But now this new thing is introduced that the kids certainly have taken to. And if they start with a regular product, a good Juul product, because it's appealing and because they're these good flavors, I imagine they're graduating then to the THC, and we should try the THC and let's do the marijuana one. And that's where the real issues have come in, right?
Well, not exactly. First of all, people have been vaping marijuana for as long as they've been vaping nicotine. And until just a few months ago, even the marijuana products with marijuana designed vaporizers have done just fine. They have an excellent safety record. The one thing that doesn't have an excellent safety record is this new concoction with THC and vitamin E. Now, the question of flavors, I think, is based on a myth. It just seems so obvious to so many people that fruit and candy flavors attract kids to use these products. Well, the cigarette companies years ago tried fruit and candy flavors, and nobody, not the kids or anybody else, would use them. The only flavor that attracted kids was menthol, and that's exactly the same flavor that attracted adults. So you can't say it was just precisely aimed at kids. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with banning flavors in e-cigarette devices is that the flavors are very important to smokers who are using these products to quit cigarettes. The way that works is that when an ex-smoker who's vaping switches from the tobacco flavor to a fruit or candy flavor, they discover they no longer like the taste of tobacco. Once that transition occurs, when the urge to smoke returns, they don't go back to cigarettes. They go back to the candy or fruit-flavored e-cigarette. So banning the flavors will reduce the efficacy for smokers who are using it to quit. I don't think banning the flavors will reduce teen use of these products at all. I think that's purely a myth.
Let me read something from one of these stories to you. Nancy Brown, CEO of the American Heart Association, said that vaping companies such as Juul have targeted youth and adolescents through marketing campaigns and flavors that attract kids. Quote, federal officials should immediately remove all flavored e-cigarettes from the market, Brown said. They should also take other necessary measures to end all marketing to children, prohibit online sales of e-cigarettes, exercise rigorous pre-market review, and closely review e-cigarette products already on the market. You would disagree with that statement then, right?
I would say that statement is based more on myth than fact. Now, there are a couple of studies out there where they ask, you know, kids and adults what flavors they prefer, and it showed that more kids, if they're going to vape, prefer fruit and candy flavors, and adults who are just experimenting with e-cigarettes favor the tobacco. So based on that statement of preference, they've concluded that the flavors must attract kids. There's no evidence that eliminating the flavors will reduce the number of kids who are vaping. And as I said before, this was tried with cigarettes, and flavoring the cigarettes just didn't work.
Then do you think that the sales should be restricted? I believe Illinois passed a law recently. Should sales be restricted to anybody under 21?
Yeah, well, let's put it this way. First of all, sales are generally restricted almost anywhere to kids under 18. Now, the difference between 18 and 21 is access in the high school environment. Mm-hmm. Somewhere around 20% of high school seniors are 18 years of age or above. And so they can make it available in the high school environment. The vast majority of kids who vape, in fact, the vast majority of kids who smoke who are under 18 years of age, didn't buy it at a store online. They bought it or got it from a friend. Now, raising the age of purchase from 18 to 21 is a big step towards getting it out of the high school environment, so those 18-year-old high school seniors have very limited access to this stuff. That would be a very important step to take. Another thing that nobody seems to be talking about is that they also have basically the same array of tobacco and marijuana products in England that they have here. But Great Britain has not had an epidemic of vaping in their high school students. They have not had kids claiming to become addicted to Juul, and they have not had any of them pneumonia.
Well, what's the difference over there?
Well, there are several differences over there. Number one, the British authorities, rather than banning all this stuff, restrict the marketing and allow the vape companies to say, you can use this stuff to quit smoking. It puts a whole different view on it. Instead of being the cool, forbidden thing to do, this is something you can do if you're smoking to stop smoking. The second thing that they've done is they've reduced the allowable content of nicotine in the cartridges. The American Juul cartridges contain 5 milligrams of nicotine per milliliter. The allowable maximum in Great Britain is 2 milligrams per milliliter.
Mm.
And apparently that's enough to moderate the nicotine hit and prevent kids from becoming addicted to it.
How does that work for people quitting smoking? Is it not nearly? I wonder if it's not as effective if somebody who's trying to quit smoking over there is more likely to still smoke because they're not getting their nicotine fix.
Well, it's less effective for quitting smoking. The one statistic that nobody seems to be talking about in this area is that from 2018 to 2019, the data gathered by the Americans, the rate of smoking cigarettes among teens has dropped from 8.2 to 5.7%. This is a 25% reduction in 1 year. Mm-hmm. And that seems to suggest that this high dose of nicotine that's causing all these other problems is much more effective than anything else we've tried to get kids to stop smoking.
Well, in that amount of time, maybe, but getting down to 8.2% is a big victory over 20 years ago, I bet, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a big victory. I mean, we have a situation where, you know, because of the relentless anti-cigarette smoking, there's been a steady, slow but steady year-by-year drop. The advent of e-cigarettes accelerated the reduction of smoking among kids, so it's become even less frequent. One of the things that we worry about is that all this anti-e-cigarette programming, the banning of flavors, the restrictions in use, some states even banning e-cigarettes altogether, is going to drive all these people, both the kids and the adults, to both contraband vape products and back to cigarettes,
yeah,
which will be a big step backwards from a public health perspective.
So,
now,
go ahead.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind that the only tobacco product that kills substantial numbers of people is cigarettes. The CDC estimate is that cigarettes kill 1,300 Americans each and every day. That people who are regular long-term smokers, a pack or more a day, will lose 10 years of their life and have a 30 to 50% chance of dying of a cigarette-related illness. No other tobacco product or tobacco-related product is anywhere near that toxic.
Mm-hmm.
So if we come to e-cigarettes, and even if the number of deaths that we've seen so far were actually related to the nicotine e-cigarettes, that number of fatalities is trivial compared to the number who were smoking cigarettes. Now, e-cigarettes have the potential to make the real cigarettes obsolete. This could be an enormous public health victory, replacing this deadly product with a product that kills few, if any, people. But it seems like people have gotten so excited with this anti-e-cigarette rhetoric.
Well, Dr. Nitzkin,
they've forgotten how toxic cigarettes are.
Dr. Nitzkin, kids are dying. kids have died because of this. Now, maybe not because of the legal products, but because this industry has been created and it's being supported by the tobacco industry, and it's a moneymaker for them.
Whoa. You're moving a little bit too fast. First of all, e-cigarettes were invented by somebody that was totally outside the big cigarette tobacco industry.
I'm sorry, who owns the Juul company?
The big tobacco cigarette companies were late in coming into the e-cigarettes. Now, Altria, the makers, well, it's actually Philip Morris International, the makers of Marlboro cigarettes, bought up 30-some percent of the Juul company.
Okay.
The reason these big tobacco cigarette companies got into the e-cigarette business is they were afraid of being what they call Kodak. Kodak, if you can remember, was the big company in terms of film photography. Along came digital photography, and Kodak didn't move into it, and because of that, Kodak went belly up. These cigarette companies have bought into vape products because they're afraid that these vape products might make cigarettes obsolete.
Okay, so it's a moneymaker
for
them.
So they didn't invite it, they didn't start it. It's their goal to make money. Yeah,
right.
Sure, they would like to addict everybody to these new products, but
right.
That's something that wise and effective public health regulation can prevent. But it's wrong to say that vaping is an invention of the big tobacco cigarette companies for the purpose of addicting another generation of kids.
Fine, it wasn't an invention of theirs, but it's their goal now. I mean, if they own it and it's a moneymaker, they want people using the products. I mean, that's safe to say, right?
Yeah, that's safe to say. They definitely want to make money doing this. And how is public health, you know, to respond? Is our goal trying to damage and put big cigarette companies out of business because we don't like them, because they've been liars and cheats and racketeers in the past? Or should our goal be protection of the health of the American people?
Well,
nobody ever envisioned that the cigarette companies might be selling a product that could save lives by weaning people off cigarettes.
Well, it's tough to a doctor. I mean, you're giving them credit for they're saving lives by weaning people off cigarettes. They're saving lives by weaning them off the product that they have that's killing people. I mean, that's hard to give them all this kudos for what they're doing, because they're still going from one addiction to another. And yes, if it's safe, that's completely different. You said that in the last decade there have been no vaping-related deaths or injuries on the legal product that's regulated and done well. It's this black market stuff that's the issue. But, big tobacco has a history of marketing towards kids and trying to get people to use cigarettes and things like that. So we just lost Dr. Juul. I don't know what just happened. I don't think it was something I said. I'm assuming that he got cut off. Let's take a quick break, and we'll go to the news next here on 720 WGN. That was just an issue with Dr. Nitzkin's phone. He will jump back on with us. It wasn't something I said, even though we're having a good, healthy discussion about this. Let's get a quick check of the news, and then we'll get back to that. Chicago Stories told 24/7 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. 3:01 in the morning, here's the news with Roger Badish. Sure. Matt DeBall here with you on 720 WGN, 3:10 in the morning. Thanks for staying up late with us. We're talking about vaping and all the issues you've heard in the news recently about the illnesses, about the administration looking into banning some of the different flavors, only allowing the nicotine flavors. Dr. Juul Nitzkin, who is a fellow at the, let me make sure I get it right, the tobacco senior fellow for tobacco policy at the R Street Institute, is on the phone with us. Your phone cut off right before we were headed to the news there, Dr. Nitzkin. Just want to make sure I didn't say anything that it just broke up. Wasn't a...
Yeah.
I'm not having this.
I have no idea
anymore.
What happened.
Okay, no worries. No worries. So thank you for jumping back on with us to talk a little bit more. While we were in the news, I was reading a New York Times story from... This is, I think, a year old. Let me see this back at the top. They did a story back on August 27th of 2018 about Juul and their luring of teenagers or not, and some of the and it's very interesting little history of the company, because they talk about some of the marketing campaigns they had early on, and that early on they knew that this was more popular with teens than maybe they wanted. It, you know, the story says that they wanted to get people in their 20s and 30s to quit smoking and use this, but they found very early on that it was very appealing to teenagers. So we can set that aside. Let's not worry about that. We can disagree on that for now. That's fine. My other question I wanted to ask about, though, states are restricting. Federally, you can't buy it if you're under 18. Some states are moving to make it 21. But the online issue is another issue, that kids can pretty easily buy these things online. Do you think there should be a bigger restriction on that and more regulation on how, you know, the ease of teenagers getting these, still having it is? Or are you okay with teenagers having it and more concerned about the THC infused and the other things that people are making that are, in your mind, causing the real issue?
Well, let me put it this way. The restrictions on sales, online and otherwise, should be the same for all tobacco-related products. You shouldn't have a situation in which there are restrictions that are imposed on nicotine-based e-cigarettes that aren't based on cigarettes or cigars or hookah materials. It should be across the board. We don't want teens using any of these products.
And I apologize, I don't know, because I don't smoke. Can I buy cigarettes online? If I wanted to buy cigarettes, can I easily order those online?
Yeah, you can purchase them online.
That seems surprising.
But anyway, and some of these websites, you know, but that's not a common way of getting them. And the websites claim they have verifiable ways of restricting age. I'm not sure how well they work. But, yeah, online purchasing should be carefully looked at and be carefully restricted. Now, one of the problems that we have is that the FDA has never formally recognized a legitimate use for vaping of nicotine-based e-cigarettes. They have no manufacturing standards. They haven't promulgated any mechanism by which a potential user can tell the good stuff from the bad stuff. And their failure to do that has invited all kinds of operators, some of whom are very irresponsible, into the marketplace.
I was reading that it says that it's not regulated. They can make these under a waiver from the FDA. What is the story with that? Is it that the FDA takes so long to approve and do its research on anything? Is that what's holding up any more serious regulation of vaping? Why is it that the FDA doesn't seem to have better oversight on this?
The hang-up is within the FDA. And the hang-up is that the law says that, you know, products that are lower in risk than cigarettes should be, you know, the development and sale of them should be encouraged to give a mechanism for smokers to use such products to quit smoking and as a transition away from nicotine use at all. Well, the FDA advisory committees have adopted the attitude that they're looking for zero risk. Well, zero risk in any product is a physical impossibility, so FDA is kind of hung up. Compare this to the British, who say, okay, these products aren't risk-free. They're much lower in risk than cigarettes. We will set what, in our judgment, are reasonable safety standards. We will allow them to claim efficacy for lower risk in smoking cessation and let them market the products for those purposes. But allowing them to market it for those purposes will prohibit other forms of marketing that would, you know, appeal to kids on an emotional basis and things like that. And their system isn't perfect, but it's a whole lot better than ours. Well, right now we have a situation where FDA prohibits any of these products that we know to be lower in risk, that we know to be effective for smoking cessation. They're prohibiting the companies from saying these products are lower in risk. These products are safe for cessation. FDA prohibits them from doing it. So if they're going to sell their products, how do they let people know that they're out there?
Well, they've done an okay job of that, apparently, because a lot of people are using them, right? I mean, they've gotten around, how are we going to let people know they're out there, right?
Well, another thing is looking at the data on the high school students in the United States. I mean, from the hype coming from the public health community, you get the impression that these products are recruiting lots of non-smoking kids, or kids who have never wanted to smoke, to use of these products. That's not what the data show. The data show that lots of kids of all types experiment with these products, maybe use them occasionally. But when you take a look at kids who use them 20 times or more a month, more than 95% of these kids have either been smoking themselves or have in the past used marijuana. So this idea of them recruiting lots of kids who otherwise wouldn't have smoked cigarettes or wouldn't have smoked marijuana isn't borne out by the data to date, even with the reports of these of this epidemic.
The studies show that up to 25% of kids in high school are vaping. Were 25%
of the kids in high school have tried a vape product.
Okay, we're up
within
to 25,
the last 30 days.
We're up to 25% of kids in high school smoking cigarettes? And the numbers were small, were well smaller than that, weren't they?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about. Are you talking about
had tried to smoke
occasionally experimenting with them? Yeah, about 20% of the kids have experimented with cigarettes. They try it and they don't follow through.
Dr. Nitzkin, you'd have to agree that this is not a precedent you'd like, that this many kids are trying. The New York Times article that I was reading from today, the girl was at the Crystal Lake High School where they were doing all this, and she was talking to the kids and saying, yeah, it says, 25% of kids have tried this, and the kids were laughing at her with that 25% number saying that's crazy because just about everybody has tried this. And I'm sure that that's an exaggeration, but it sounds like kids are saying that's a bit underreported, that more kids are trying this than are not. We can disagree about whether they marketed it towards kids or not, or whether that was their intention. But it seems frightening that America had done a good job of getting kids away from smoking. And I know we want to help adults quit smoking, but this does seem to be an issue, I believe, greater than what you're saying. These kids trying these products, and even if, it's not that many kids trying it, any kid trying a nicotine-based product, where you said it's a lot of nicotine here in the American version of this, is setting up, and you're talking about the FDA. So in this New York Times article from last year, the FDA commissioned research published in January, so it's January 2018, found limited evidence that e-cigarettes led smokers to quit, and some evidence suggested that young people who use e-cigarettes are more likely to try actual cigarettes.
Okay. You brought up a number of different things. Yes, I agree with you. It's a very troublesome situation. It's not a situation we would desire. It is a situation that requires public health action. But as we sort all this out, we ought to identify what actions are appropriate. And we also should look across the pond and ask the question, how come the Brits haven't had these problems? Maybe there's something in the approach that they've taken it that have prevented them having the problems we're having here. Now, the evidence that e-cigarettes help people quit is based on population data showing that more people have quit smoking using e-cigarettes than any of the pharmaceutical preparations. Quitting cold turkey is still best. FDA considers smoking to be a disease. And because they consider it to be a disease, they consider any product that claims to be effective to help people quit smoking should be considered a drug. And the kind of study that's required for drugs is what they call randomized clinical trials. And the randomized clinical trials, with the exception of one recent one, shows that e-cigarettes are about the same efficacy as the pharmaceutical preparations. Well, the problem with that is that in real life, the pharmaceutical patches and gums and so on do not satisfy a smoker's urge to smoke, and it takes a lot of willpower and a willingness to, you know, spend a lot of money on these products to use them. But in real life, e-cigarettes are very attractive. They satisfy the urge to smoke for most of many people, and they're much more effective than the pharmaceutical preparations because people use them willingly. It's the only product that we know of that has been effective in getting people to quit smoking who had no interest in quitting smoking. So the evidence is there, but this evidence has been basically pushed aside by those in the public health community who feel that smoking is a disease and requires drug-related studies to document it.
Well, is that part of how the FDA is, though? I mean, you mentioned that in Great Britain they're doing it this way. I mean, we could go with drug after drug that has had success for years in European countries and is now just being tried here in America because we just have a much more, I don't know, would you say thorough or maybe onerous system for getting things passed and getting things approved and getting everything worked out? Is that part of it? Is just the FDA takes forever to pass anything and approve of anything?
No. Not in this particular case as I see it. If FDA considered smoking to be a behavior instead of a disease, mm-hmm. they would look to other data for evidence of efficacy. E-cigarettes are a behavioral change agent. They don't eliminate the urge to take in nicotine. They just provide a substitute, an alternate nicotine-related product, where the user continues to take in the nicotine, but by doing so, eliminates all the risk caused by the other nasty chemicals in cigarette smoke. It's an entirely different situation that requires an entirely different approach. Another thing to keep in mind with all these statistics is that the Centers for Disease Control, in their studies of vaping in high school and elsewhere, considers all vaping to be nicotine vaping, even though we realize that a lot of it is marijuana vaping and a significant amount of it is just vaping for the flavors because it's a cool activity with no active ingredient. When you start sorting through all this information, what you discover is that a lot of the so-called epidemic is probably an epidemic of marijuana vaping. The rest of it is because of the popularity of this jewel product. It's a very complex situation. It's a situation that that's not desirable, that does warrant public health action, but if we're going to take the correct action and do it sensibly, we have to recognize exactly what's going on with these kids in these schools. And the banning of flavors is just the wrong approach.
Well, there's a study cited in one of these articles that I'm reading here that says that in a survey, kids cited the flavors as one of the reasons that they enjoyed it. So I could see where the ideas, and we talk about some of the early Juul marketing and the hip, cool ways they made it look, you know, you could see where there's an argument that, hey, this was marketed towards kids. Of course, we can all agree we don't want it in high schools. We don't want anybody who wasn't smoking using these things. Question is, how do they get there? How do they put the genie back in the bottle and try to change it? Because once things get very popular with kids, and as these other articles also state, Melody Pirzada, a pediatric pulmonologist at NYU Winthrop Hospital who's treated many teens who are developing this life-threatening lung injury after vaping marijuana, she says banning flavored products might prevent teens from getting hooked, but she still sees black market products that contain THC and other substances posing the biggest risk to vapers. Go ahead.
Well, I agree with her. The problem really is the black market products, but FDA doesn't really have anything going to enable them to directly attack these black market products.
Well, how are you ever going to attack a black market product, though? I mean, people are going to make things on their own. There's only so much you can do about that, right? I mean, if the bigger goal would be get kids not to be on this in the first place. Kids are always going to find a way. Somebody's going to find a way to, especially we're in Illinois, we're going to sell recreational marijuana. There's going to be THC oils and different things people can get their hands on very easily that they can start creating this with. So I would imagine the black market is going to be there. Well, wouldn't you agree that the bigger thing is you're never going to control a black market to a great extent in certain things? We need to get kids not to want to start vaping in the first place if they're not trying to wean themselves off cigarettes.
Okay, there are a number of steps that could be taken that would move us in that direction. Step number one is prohibiting sales to kids who are under 21 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
Another step to be taken would be FDA developing manufacturing standards by which they said, okay, these products are reasonably safe. These other products are not and should be prohibited if they don't meet these quality standards. And that would give FDA a very direct way to go after the black marketeers. Now, the black marketeers aren't going to make and sell products that they can't make a profit on. And if they're going to be prosecuted, that's another inhibition for large scale, black marketing. You know, we have a lot of experience from the prohibition of alcohol 100 years ago. And apparently these lessons have not really been learned by the regulators. And the FDA right now, because of the fact that the federal government considers marijuana to be a prohibited drug, they don't have the authority to issue regulations. The only way they can regulate it is to recognize it as something that would be recognized as legal if it is made in a certain way and marketed in a certain way, allow that marketing and that sales, and go after the rest. They don't have that authority or that ability right now. And because they don't have that, they really haven't looked carefully at marijuana. Some of the data that came out for the very first time last year, focusing on the non-smokers who became regular e-cigarette vapers, half of those kids had been using marijuana before they switched to the nicotine e-cigarettes. So,
and they're stopping with the marijuana, or they're still smoking marijuana?
We don't have that information.
Yeah.
Our experience with these kids with these pneumonias is that it's very common to see kids using multiple nicotine and marijuana products all at the same time.
I'm going to end real quick here with three texts that came through. 870 writes, it may help some people quit smoking, but it is creating more people addicted to nicotine. 312 writes, I quit smoking 4 years ago. No matter what cessation product you use, withdrawal is inevitable. That's why I know people that say they quit smoking yet still use e-cigarettes a year later. Just quit and suffer the withdrawals. It worked for me. And 708 writes, smoked for 40 years, started vaping 5 years ago, haven't had a cigarette since I started vaping. I believe it saved my life. It's a complex issue. There's going to be a lot more to talk about it with this over the next year. Dr. Joel Nitzkin is a senior fellow at the Tobacco Policy at the R Street Institute. Dr. Nitzkin, I really appreciate your time tonight. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you. There's a lot to continue on this product, on this issue.
Yeah, I hope we can talk again. I appreciate it.
Okay.
All right, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's 3:30 in the morning. Let's take a quick break. We'll have the news next on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. 3:39 in the morning here on 720 WGN. We're talking about teens and vaping and smoking. Dr. Nitzkin, very interesting. He's, I thought, very defensive of the vaping companies, which is fine. he strongly believes they're more good than bad in that, they can help people, you know, get over their addictions, et cetera, et cetera. So, but clearly it's become quite an issue for teens in America. And there was a story earlier this week, a friend of mine who used to work here posted a story and talked about parents who allow their kids to drink in the home. I don't know. Roger looks like he's away from it. I don't know if he's jumping back in. Roger, are you there?
Yeah, what can I do? What can I do for you? Need some cigarettes?
I don't. I'm good.
Okay. Sorry.
But is something related when we're talking about teens and the issues they face and how we navigate what they get involved in and things like that.
Oh, it's a treacherous road.
There's a story
it really is.
USA Today earlier this week about a headline study, parents who give their teenagers alcohol are inviting trouble. And a friend of mine, Laura Hirsch, who used to produce here at GM a long time ago, put that on her Facebook page and said, note to any parents of friends of mine, your kids will not drink if they're at my house. I will never allow that. We have never allowed drinking at our house among teenagers. When we were having Jack's high school graduation party, we said, you know, if you want to invite some friends from school, you're more than welcome to. And he said, are you going to allow them to drink? And we said, no. And he said, then I'm not going to bother because I know they won't come. And I thought that was sad. But
yeah.
He said, yeah, that's how it's going to be. And we said, that's fine. Then they don't need to come. And we're cool with that. Don't invite them. Don't worry about it.
Right.
We have some other friends who have a daughter who's a few years older than Jack in the neighborhood. And when she was in high school and at the end of her high school career, they had let her drink in the house with her friends. And I respect them. I'm great friends with them. And I think they're good people and good parents. But I was like, wow, that is not a choice I would make. I don't know if one's better than the other. You know, the justification that people give is, I'd rather my kids learn to do this in front of me, not being out doing it somewhere else. Learn a little moderation, learn things like that, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
It's a slippery slope, it seems.
It is. And here's the argument. It's not even an argument. Here are the justifications. You know your child. Hopefully, you know your children the best. You know if they can handle certain situations in life. I always felt that I was sheltered when I was growing up by my parents, though I learned a lot more that I'm sure they probably didn't want me to know. From classmates, from my other friends, from other people I knew. You know what I'm saying? I didn't engage in any of that stuff. Actually, I started smoking in grade school. My parents both smoked. Not heavy. I mean, not a regular smoker. I stole some cigarettes. And one of my friends and I went up to a forest in the neighborhood and climbed a tree and smoked a couple of cigarettes. Once in a while.
I imagine that was a very common story back then, too.
Well, because more people smoked back then. I smoked in junior high a little bit, and I didn't pick it up again until after college. I did pipe smoking in college. But the point being, without going more into it, the point being, I don't think I would have done that had I had a good relationship with my parents where I could have talked with them about it, as opposed to everything being taboo and don't even think about it. Well, I'm thinking about it. You can't tell me not to think about it, you know? And we know that children, as they're younger, are very curious. You know, it's the old line, don't stick your hand in the flame. It'll hurt. Well, let me figure that out for myself. And then, ouch, guess what? That hurts. So I think you need to know your child. You need to have a good relationship with your child. That still doesn't mean you're going to allow them to smoke or drink before they should be able to consider that on their own based on a judgment based in fact.
Well, and I think that the cigarette smoking versus the drinking are slightly two different things, because the cigarette smoking comes with the inherent danger of addiction. And I know alcohol.
Oh, so does alcohol. I mean, seriously.
But you get addicted to cigarettes more quickly, I'd say, than you become an alcoholic.
I don't think there's a differentiation on that.
I believe there's a huge differentiation on that. Millions of Americans, millions and millions and millions of Americans. Roger, I like having a beer. I like having a drink. I like having a mojito. I like all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. I'm not addicted to it. There's very few people that say, oh, I have a cigarette here and there.
All right, take it from one who smoked 3 packs a day.
Do you ever have 3 beers every day and couldn't stop yourself?
No.
Okay.
But I could stop my smoking, too.
Your 3 packs a day, you could have just quit that easily?
I did.
At any time?
Cold turkey.
And it was simple?
Yes.
You are the anomaly, my friend. You know.
Well, I don't know. I think there's more of a physical reaction in stopping drinking than there is in stopping smoking. I'm talking about the physical reaction to the stopping. And if you are addicted to alcohol, I think your body is going to go through more of a strenuous withdrawal than if you're addicted to smoking and you stop and you go through withdrawal.
Well, you're talking about an alcoholic, though.
Well, I'm talking, if you're addicted to alcohol, you're drinking. You're an alcoholic.
Drinking, right.
If you're addicted, you're an alcoholic. It doesn't matter. If you're addicted to smoking and you stop, the physical effect on your body, the withdrawal process, is less strenuous on your body than the alcohol withdrawal.
That's fine. But what I'm saying, Roger, is with teens, with anybody starting out, I don't think that, you know, you get addicted to cigarettes relatively quickly. You were having 3 packs of cigarettes a day at one point. Okay, that's, mm-hmm. You know, you weren't ever having 20 beers a day at any point.
I wasn't, but I went through 3 packs of cigarettes a day because I was smoking all day long. I wasn't chain smoking. I would be...
Either way, that's a lot of cigarettes. Well, it's a lot of smoking.
Yeah.
I don't know why you and I are
But I'm not saying... I don't think I was addicted to it. I just smoked a lot.
Just enjoyed it that much.
Well, I guess, yeah. I mean, I don't know what the reasons were for it. I just did it.
Because you were addicted?
No.
Anyways... Point is,
yes.
I think it's slightly different things. I don't think it's quite all along in the same area.
And you know, we could get scientists in to, you know, to talk about the differences and the similarities between the two.
Sure.
I wouldn't mind hearing about it, to be honest with you. I mean, that's an interesting point. Why do people get addicted to these two types of things? What is the causation of it?
Well, with cigarettes, it's the nicotine.
Right, and other chemicals that they put in it, and it's been proven that they put other stuff in it that attracts it to other parts of your brain, other satisfaction sections of your brain. The nicotine is affecting your lungs. The tar and nicotine is affecting your lungs and your breathing and all that stuff, but there's other chemicals in it that attract the cigarettes to you. In other words, it makes you feel better. That's not the nicotine or the tar.
So let's set cigarette smoking aside for right now.
Yes,
we just
sir.
Did an hour on that. Let's jump over to teenagers and drinking and parents mm-hmm. who decide to, you know, allow this to be introduced in the home.
Right.
Story from USA Today. To some, it seems to make sense. Let your teenagers drink at home where they will have adult supervision and won't be driving. But a new study finds that parents who provide their kids with alcohol aren't doing them any favors. Teens whose early exposure to alcohol comes from home aren't protected against the dangers of alcohol and may even be more likely to drink and suffer alcohol-related harms, according to a study in Lancet Public Health, which followed 1,900 Australian adolescents for 6 years. The parents' aims are admirable, but they're wrong, said Richard Maddock, who led the research. When you look across a large number of people, what you find is there's no benefit. Providing alcohol to adolescents, he said, implies that parents approve of drinking. I don't think it's complex. I think it's that simple. The new study looked at both at parents who gave their children occasional sips of alcohol versus those who provided full glasses of beer or wine and found little difference. Giving whole glasses is probably worse than giving sips, but giving sips does not protect and still causes harm, said Maddock, a professor of drug and alcohol studies at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. Although the new study is bigger and longer lasting than most previous research, other advocates and scientists have long opposed the idea of adults providing alcohol or hosting drinking parties for teens. The bottom line is providing alcohol for young people basically backfires, said the director of the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, a federal agency. Throwing a party inevitably means teens who are already heavy drinkers will turn up, he said, and they train the other kids to be binge drinkers. 31 states have so-called social host laws where party hosts are held responsible for car accidents and other disasters resulting from alcohol use at their home. 10 of those and many local ordinances single out underage parties. Alan Goodwin, principal of Walt Whitman High School in Montgomery County, Maryland, said parents continue to throw drinking parties for teens despite a local social host law and his own tirades against the practice. I get why they do it because they know the kids are going to drink anyway, but it really sends the wrong message when parents do it and put other children in danger. And that's the other issue is, you know, you're inviting other kids. Texter says underage drinking is illegal. If you think your kid can handle it, fine, but don't enable other parents' underage kids to drink. 847 says an addiction is an addiction. Smoking is just as hard to quit as alcohol. To quit a three-pack addiction is a phenomenon. 661 says when I was a kid, my mom would write a note and send me to the store saying it was okay to sell me a pack of cigarettes. How insane was that?
We used to do that.
My sister did that for my mom once.
Sure.
309 says, I have to agree with Roger. There's a very large mental component to addiction. I'm 54 and have smoked since I was 14. I got sick last year, went in the hospital for a week around Christmas, and almost had to come home on oxygen permanently. I haven't smoked a cigarette since, and I never will again. We all have the ability to quit doing something. It's just some are stronger than others. Did your kids ever, when you were raising your kids was probably the 80s, right? Mostly-ish?
Well, they're 10 years apart.
Okay. So what? What two decades were they?
Well, so our daughter was born in 78, and our son in 88.
Oh, okay. So yeah. So
yeah, 10 years apart.
78 and 88. Yeah. So let's see, 88. So 98. So mid-90s and mid-2000s mm-hmm. were their teenage years.
Okay. Yeah.
And was there ever a question of a teenager being able to drink in your house, or was that something?
No, first of all, we never drank. I mean, if we had a glass of wine with dinner, it was either a religious service, which was once or twice a year, mm-hmm. Or it was just me and Bridget having dinner, not with the kids. In other words, going out for dinner, we'd have a glass of wine. Bridget doesn't care much for alcohol. I don't care much for alcohol. Our children didn't drink, to our knowledge.
Do they drink now as adults?
Yes, they do.
It's very interesting because with that study, I would like to see a study because I rarely drink in front of the kids. Like, I never drink with dinner. I don't have, like, a beer with dinner. Mm-hmm. We don't have drink wine in the house. We drink when friends are over or when we go out. Now, our kids have known we've gotten drunk. They've known at Halloween parties we've gotten drunk, that the neighbors, you know, we've told funny mm-hmm. stories.
Right.
So we've, you know.
Well, our kids.
I worry yeah. that we've softened the idea of, oh, it's not
really?
That bad. It's okay. Well, if I think about it, that we've talked about it in such a way like it was funny or it was this or, mm-hmm. you know, the neighbor was throwing up or whatever, or, you know, the neighbor passed out early at the party. She just went up to bed, things like that. We have, you know, given it this, oh, it's not a big deal. And so that concerns me. And when they do a study about kids being allowed to drink in the home, I'd like to see a study about parents that drink in the home. And is that just as, as
yeah.
harmful? And that might, well, we saw my parents doing that all the time, or they would drink, or, you know, they go out. And does that enable this idea that, hey, it's okay? We're going up, I won't be here next weekend because we're going to go up to Nebraska to go visit Jack.
Right.
And Ohio State's in town. There's going to be a big football game.
Mm-hmm. And a big party.
And so I said to Jack, hey, you know, I could buy a parking pass and we could tailgate. Would you have a bunch of people that would want to come? I'll do that if you think you'd bring a bunch of people. We'll cook and blah, blah. And he said, well, I don't know. Will you allow them to drink? And I said, no, I will not. That's you.
Well, first of all, you're responsible. And if they're underage, you're responsible.
I'm not going to do that.
Right.
I can't control what they're doing, but I will not be providing alcohol to them.
Right.
He said, all right, well, let me see that. And it was like, you know, they're going to other tailgates where people are letting them drink. And you know, the same thing when he said that about the graduation party, other graduation parties he went to, parents were allowing the kids to drink.
Mm.
And, you know, I just don't feel right in taking part in that. I'm worried enough about what he's doing. I'm certainly not going to be responsible for giving stuff to other kids. And that's more what it's about to me, is like, these are other kids and other parents and their lives. I'm not going to be the one giving them stuff illegally when they're underage.
And that's responsible.
815 says, it sends very mixed messages to kids. You ask them to respect the law, and then you allow them to break it when they're with you. 847, Kurt writes, are you aware that in Wisconsin, children of any age can drink in a restaurant with a parent? I believe that's true. I have heard that. I don't know about any.
Really?
I don't know if I came in there with my 10-year-old, if I could order him an old-fashioned. But I have heard that if you, when you're with your parents, you know, if they'll let kids drink. Somebody else confirmed that with me, but I believe that is true.
Well, I'm sure that's written in Wisconsin law somewhere, right?
Or it's just one of those colloquial things. I don't know. All right, we've got to take a quick break. We've got the news that matters from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom coming up in just a moment here on 720 WGN.
You're making me feel maybe I am somebody. I can deal with the bad nights.
Good morning, everybody. We got another hour until Orion Samuelson says good morning, and we get the morning show going here on 720 WGN. Joining us right now in studio is Casey Clark. He is the CEO of Cultivate Advisors. Joining him in studio, by the way, with us right now is Mrs. Clark, who is celebrating a birthday today. So thank you so much, Mrs. Clark, for getting up early to be with us. We appreciate that. She's embarrassed by that, but she also doesn't trust her husband
very
much. Says, you're not going out at 4 in the morning without me. Where are we going? You do have something a little better planned for today than just this, I'm hoping.
We do. We've got brunch. We're going to have some fun. We're making her favorite meal, linguine and clams, later tonight. So, should be a good time. Should be a good time.
Like about
we're expecting
years.
Our first,
That sounds
too.
Like about 10 years of marriage right there.
We're expecting our first here in about 4 or 5 weeks. So, we are,
congratulations.
You know, nice and relaxed right now.
Oh, nice. So, good for you. I would have never, I know it's dark in here, but I had no idea you were even pregnant. Not that I would have asked. I've learned that lesson long ago. You don't do that. Well, congratulations to you both. I'm very excited for you. So, your first child coming up here in just a few
weeks. Yeah, we're excited.
Oh, man. That's a new small business you're going to be running.
That is a new small business we're going to be running.
With all these things, you have no idea how they work.
Oh, I don't think she's going to want me to advise that business, though. I think I'm going to have to be an active business owner.
Well, you know, one thing I've learned in my 20 years of marriage is I wouldn't say, well, honey, here's how you have to look at things. And, like, don't give her the whole business model of it. She'll just smack you upside the head with the frying pan.
Sure.
It's all brand new. Well,
there we go.
Congratulations to you both. That's going to be awesome.
Thank you.
I want to talk to you about Cultivate Advisors, your company, and your past.
Awesome.
In the entrepreneurial world, we love talking to entrepreneurs on the show. And, you know, I think a lot of us out there, I have a small little company, but I think a lot of people, even in their day-to-day lives, dream about, I'm going to go buy a bar, I'm going to run a restaurant, I'm going to do something that is my passion. Because so many of us end up with mortgages and things that prevent us from pursuing our passions and just pursuing the paychecks that keep our lives going, right? You started out in franchising.
Explain
to me your origins.
Yeah, I was in a home service franchise organization. So actually, while I was in university, I was running a small painting business. And not the, you know, maybe the sexiest business, but it was a business
but
where
probably pretty common for college students, right? Something like that. Window washing. I know I went to St. Mary's in Winona, Minnesota, and I served on the advisory board of their Kabar Institute.
Okay.
And we had these kids in that are starting things, and there's a student up there who started this window washing business. And
he
was expanding it and doing great, paying his way through college with a small window washing business.
It was an awesome business, right? I mean, you know, you're into my college years, I had, you know, 40, 45 employees that I was running as a business owner over the summers and working with all these customers.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was the start. That was when I got the bug. And I went, why would I go work for someone else? Why would I go, you know, work, you know, clock in, clock out, when I have the ability to have my own autonomy and, you know, navigate the growth of the business? So that's where I got my start, was as a franchisee. And then I got tapped on the shoulder. They brought me up into the franchisor, and I started training these business owners how to get off the ground and how to scale their painting business, you know, throughout the U.S. And from there, it kind of took off. And by the end of it, I left, you know, after running majority of the central part of the U.S., and that was, I think that's what hooked me in terms of the passion that I had towards helping business owners, you know, take the passion and turn it into a reality, because there's so many other core skills that go in to getting that passion off the ground besides just being into the industry, right?
Yeah.
It's not just industry, you're running a business.
So you started out kind of running things yourself, but then the company brought you in. So then you were working for the company for a while. So you did see both ends of the spectrum. And did that eventually make you say, I want to do my own thing again.
I actually had all three. So I was a franchisee, so I had full ownership. Then I went into more of a support role where I was the employee. Okay. That was terrible for me, transparently.
Yeah.
Because that definitely helped me realize what was going to take place in my life. And then after that, I actually came in as a partner of the organization. Okay. And then started helping drive the growth of the business. So I got to experience all three, which I think does give me a very unique lens into businesses and understanding what does it mean to actually train a business owner, but then also what does it mean to be the driver and on the field as the main player.
And what made you decide to leave and pursue other passions?
You know, I was there for over a decade, and what I found is that although painting was a good business and a good vehicle to teach someone how to run a business, I think I was ready to go into some different industries. Yeah. And what I really saw was that these younger folks that were learning how to run businesses, you know, a lot of the people we worked with were either in college or just out of college. That was kind of the model of the franchise system. When I started looking at the outside space, I started realizing how many of these other business owners were getting started, you know, in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, even 60s, and going, it was just pure passion and pure, you know, some dream, some vision, but they didn't have the tools on how to get there. So I was looking at everything we were teaching these folks and going, I bet we could take this to the outside world. And we were right. We were able to get off the ground pretty quick.
So when I started my company back in 2005, I had been producing here, making no money at all.
Yep.
So it was very easy for me to say, hey, I'm going to start my own company.
Yeah.
Because if it failed, I wasn't losing that much money anyways. I could go find another job.
Yeah.
When you had made it where you had made it to then leave and go pursue something else, I guess I could say, oh, you had gotten comfortable, so it was easier for you to do.
Yeah.
But I imagine once you're making a certain amount of money, it's harder to say, I'm going to give this sure thing up and go try this again on my own. For people who want to make that leap, what's your advice and how hard is it to say, okay, let's leave what's sure and insurance and all those good things we take for granted and jump into this head first, not knowing what's truly going to happen?
Well, we've got these five stages of how to run a business, and one of the first ones is actually called the hustler. And so my story is actually a little different than that. I didn't actually have to take that jump because I just double dipped for 2 years.
Okay.
So, you know, it's called grind it out, 80 hours a week. If you're really that passionate and you want to achieve your dreams, that's what you're going to do. So I think you got to know your own financial situation and what you're capable of doing. I'm definitely all about going all in on a business and making that your sole focus and your priority. There is, you know, such a thing as squirrel syndrome, right? Where you're jumping all around between all these hobbies trying to figure out what's important to you.
Yeah.
But if you know you have the business, don't be afraid to do what I did. I see so many others do that end up being successful is you just go, I'm going to build this, you know, so between, you know, 5 p.m. and midnight and between, you know, 4 a.m. and 7 a.m., I'm going to build a business while I'm also doing this other role that's just as important to me.
Okay, so that was when you were younger, and that was easier.
Yeah,
and a lot of our listeners would be in their 40s or so, or maybe have a baby on the way.
Yeah.
I mean, three months from now, if you said to your wife, honey, while I'm doing the 2 a.m. feeding, I'm also going to be running some spreadsheets. It's cool. I can do it all. It just gets harder and harder. The more debt we have, the more mortgage we have, the more kids we have, the more everything else. So what's your advice for people in their 40s and 50s who are like, God, I really want to pursue a passion?
Yeah.
If you don't have the 80 hours a week, is it don't do it then? Or just if you really are passionate, you'll find the time?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of ways to get the financing set up to get a business off the ground. Either you're going to pull the financing in, right? And so you're making that conscious decision. Make sure you have a nice, you know, 2-year performa in place that somebody else has helped you build, because you'll be too optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be so excited about what you're going to go create, right? The goal is going to be up here and the reality is might be down here. So have somebody else who has those insights to go, this is probably a little more realistic. Let's see what the worst case analysis is. But I think, you know, outside of it, there's a lot of grants out there. There's a lot of great programs that'll help fund you and get you going and get you off the ground as a small business owner. So you want to take advantage of those as well. But I will tell you, I mean, most of our, you know, and I'm speaking mostly from our clients, we've seen a lot of people leave the corporate world or different industries and decide to start their own business. And I'll tell you, most of them end up grinding it out with two, even with multiple kids. I mean, it's just, you know,
they keep the job and start the new company.
They do. I mean, that's majority of the model that we see that these small business owners get off the ground. And obviously, you can get tech or some of the other businesses that are able to go out and get VC funding early on, but that's going to be rare in unicorns.
So would you say in general that is the way to do it, or that's the scared way to do it? Because you're starting it because, well, I still need that income. I can't guarantee this is going to work out. So I'm not, you know, completely jumping off the deep end here.
Again, you know, it's I think when you're pushed and when you're stretched like that, you're going to know what's important to you. And I actually think when you're grinding like that, it's actually easier to make the jump, because what happens is that you get in, let's call it 3-4 months in. Every business, every industry is different, but you start to generate revenue and you start to see what you're doing and go, am I getting any type of traction with this?
Yeah.
And if you are, that's when it now triggers you to give you the confidence to jump. So I think people have to go through that self-doubt issue of, you know, kind of coming to the place of going, I am going to make the jump. Now, if they already know they're going to make the jump, get the financials in order, get everything in place, and go all in the business. We're definitely ones to get in front of our clients to say, hey, it's time to leave this other, you know, role. You're leaning on it. I still remember one of my first clients I worked with. She was a real estate agent, very successful, but she was also still at the, you know, the hospitality world, going into the Trump Tower, other places, and providing a waitress, right? Being a waitress for these large catering events. So she would burn the midnight oil doing these larger events 3 to 4 times a week. But here I'm meeting with her. She's 6-7 years in on the business of running real estate. She's making over 6 figures a year. And I'm going, why are you still doing this and stretching yourself? It took me 2.5 years to finally convince her to leave, because that was just her comfortability.
Yeah.
And so you see that a lot with these small business owners, because, you know, a lot of these folks, they don't want to put that much capital into it. They don't want to infuse the finance. They don't want to take the debt risk. But they have this passion. They have this drive for autonomy. They want to make more of an impact in what they're doing. It's a hard, everybody has to go through their journey a little differently.
Yeah. All right. So let's jump to, you did the franchising, you worked in the company, you leave and you form Cultivate Advisors. Tell me what Cultivate Advisors is.
Yeah. So I co-founded Cultivate Advisors. So with a business partner that I met in the painting world, we were big competitors. His name's Dan Grom out of Milwaukee. And so when we had this idea, we were looking at the market and I read this article from Forbes at the time that said, small business coaching is one of the fastest growing industries, you know, taking off in the US right now. So I started looking around and I started realizing there was no company out there that had become the voice of small business. There was a lot of people pre-revenue that wanted to get in and do investment capital raising. There was a lot of folks that would offer consulting for medium-sized businesses. And then you'd find your mentors or your small business coaches, but there wasn't necessarily an established company that was spread throughout the US that was known as the company to call if you were a small business and you want to grow, that was there to teach you the fundamentals of how to run, grow, and scale a business, not teach you your industry. Very, very different. So the folks we work with, they know their industry. We come in as their partner to teach the business acumen side and partner with them to help pull them sometimes, drag them sometimes, push them at times across whatever line they're working towards in their business.
Interesting. And you have, you said 40 full-time employees working with how many different companies around the country right now?
So right now, actively who we work with, we're just over 450 is where we're at. We've worked with a total of about 750 in the last 3 years.
So when you say working on the business side of it, they know their industry, you need the business side of it. What does that mean? What are the parts that most small business owners are not tackling well?
Well, it's wearing all the hats of the business is what we call it, right? So you've got financials. That's probably the big one that we see. Most people just don't have the understanding of how to manage the financials. I'm not talking about accounting. I'm actually talking about cash flow. I'm talking about the operational side of financials. Mm-hmm. You've got recruiting. How do I bring on talent? When do I know when to hire? How should I hire? And then you get to leadership. When do I build a leadership team? How do I lead? How does that work? I have to build a sales process. I have to build a marketing engine and a funnel that's going to be sustainable and consistent. Productivity, though, how do I manage my calendar? How do I get the most out of my output, especially as a small solopreneur if you're in those earlier stages?
Yeah.
The only way you're going to scale is you've got to get really scrappy and you've got to figure out how to get out of that. And the only way to do that is to be overproductive than everybody else.
And then bring people in, right? Eventually, you have to bring people in and build it up. And I found that that's one of the toughest things to figure out how to do, because
human capital.
When you're used to doing everything, then I'm going to bring somebody else in and hand them things to do, but then I'm naturally going to then watch over and say,
yes.
Well, this is how I do. Well, this is, well, and then I'm just now wasting money on things and maybe even stretching myself more thin because now I'm babysitting something that I should have passed off completely. Is that very tough for most people to let go? Is there their letting go process? You have to hire and trust?
Totally. I mean, I think there's three triggers when it comes to the org chart growth, right? It's when you're the solopreneur and you're growing out of that stage. It's like, when do I hire? Who do I hire? And how do I lead these one or two people and give up that control? That is one trigger. The other place is when we call it getting up to a leadership of capacity. Meaning, as a leader, you're no longer really focused on the end user of your business. You're now more focused on your team, and you've got a full team reporting to you, but you're still driving the day-to-day. That's a hard time because they have to understand that they have to leave the end user, and now their business is about leading their employees, not the end user. Mm. And then the third one is when they get even larger, and they bring in that leadership team, and now they've lost control. Now they're not able to, you know, they're just setting the goal. They're not actually able to set the path. And those are really the three triggers where we see people get extremely uncomfortable and get in that position where they go, please help. How do I do this? How do I navigate this? Not just mindset, but tactics. Because even like you just said, are you babysitting? Are you following up with these people? My gut says if somebody's feeling that way, they're actually having a skill issue. They don't either. They don't know who to hire, and they need help with that. They don't know how to onboard, train, set expectations properly, or they don't know how to lead properly. And you get those three things right, it doesn't have to be what you just said, where it's babysitting. It can actually be, wow, this person's more talented than me, and they're taking this business faster than I ever could. And that's hard to do, but if you hone in, you can create it.
Is that a problem? I would imagine that, I think, looking back, that's been an issue for me over the years, is that we know we need somebody else, we know we need to take some things off our plate, but we don't plan out exactly what that means. We just bring somebody in, and then we're sort of figuring out what in the world they're doing, and it doesn't flow well.
I mean, exactly. I mean, that's the epitome of most small business owners. Head down, driving through concrete walls, grinding out the business versus taking the space to work on the business. Think, you know, strategically, look out long term and figure out who's the persona I want to work with, who's going to help us take the business to the next level, and what's that ROI going to be worth. And it's risky. I mean, you build up as a solopreneur, you build up to the point where you have a good amount of money coming in. And then you have to go, I'm going to cut my earnings in half so I can bring somebody else in.
Right.
And I have to hope it's going to return better. And it may only return better by 10, 15%. It may not be that big of a return. You really don't see it till you're maybe 4 or 5 employees in most industries.
Mm.
That's a hard moment to get your hands wrapped around, especially a first-time business owner, going, how am I going to do this? And is it worth it? So fear sets in.
So when you want to grow the company and you're talking about bringing somebody else on, do you have to make it more of a down the road plan that this might not pay its dividends right away? We might make less money right away, but it's important for the strategic growth of the company. If we know to get bigger, we have to grow, but we're say a certain percent profitable right now. But once we bring this other person on, we can't grow as fast as we need to. We're not going to be as profitable, but 3 years down the road, we should be. Do you have to look that far ahead?
I mean, actually, we say you have to look 5 years ahead as a small business owner. You have to know, you know, short term, you have to know what your cash flow looks like over the next 2 years. Anything after that, who knows if it's going to be the reality.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the metrics and what the growth of the company is going to do and will it sustain, we're looking 5 years out. But again, every business is different, right? I can think of a client we had a few months ago where, you know, she came to us and we actually within the first month said, okay, you're going to be hiring 3 employees, just so you know. She was that overstretched. She had waited too long. So mm-hmm. It's not always, yeah, let's plan it out and go slow. Sometimes sure. Reality is go.
Could she afford to hire 3 people?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, well, again, you know, and we talk through this and we have a methodology, these 5 stages that every entrepreneur goes through. But one of the things we talk about is when you're first hiring, you've got to hire entrepreneurial folks. You've got to get really creative with compensation. Too often as entrepreneurs, we're too afraid to give up any part of the company. And so it's very common those first few employees. You see any of these large tech companies that really grow and really explode, they do the same thing. They give those first few employees options or ways to feel part of the profit sharing in a non-conventional way.
So
that's important.
Get paid almost nothing and work 100
exactly.
hours
put
a week.
Put the person on commission.
It.
Get somebody like you because you want to bring in an entrepreneur because they're going to be just like you those first few employees, right? They're going to wear all the different hats, all different tasks. You can't have a specialist in the role at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to bring somebody in that wants to look at this and take ownership over the business just like you. You've got to figure out how to duplicate yourself. And those first 2 or 3 employees, they will dictate your success. We've seen that over and over again.
That's got to be really hard, though, because not only are you hiring somebody and really entrusting them, you're giving them a piece of your vision, too, in your company.
Yeah. And there's ways to do it where you don't have to give away a piece. I don't want to make it sound like you should give up equity. I don't believe sure. in giving out a lot of equity when you grow a business. But there is a way to do it and get creative with compensation to where you will attract that entrepreneur. Because there's folks out there that want the impact. They want the passion. Our biggest piece of advice is always find an entrepreneur that wants to run their own business in the future. And they want to use the opportunity with you as a catalyst, as a vehicle to learn mm-hmm. how to run, grow, and scale a company
themselves.
Is it
easy to find those people? I mean, when you say this, I'm thinking, okay, somebody young just out of college who doesn't have a mortgage yet and have all these mm-hmm. things that need a big salary and all these things.
No, I mean, sure, that's one place. That's not necessarily where I would go, depending on the business. It depends on the industry, really, and what you know skill levels required. But no, I mean, again, and I'm not saying you don't pay a small salary. I'm not saying you don't offer, you know, some small amount of benefits. There's so many great programs out there for small business owners now to help support and bring all the resources in. But no, I mean, I'm saying, you know, if maybe the market is says you need to bring in somebody at $80,000 a year, you know, bring them in at 40 and put a commission yield on, you know, how much it's going to take to hit X, Y, and Z results. Because you're probably hiring a salesperson. You're probably hiring somebody that's going to help drive revenue. That's where you should stay focused early on.
Mm-hmm.
That's normally how it works. Because if you're hiring somebody operationally, you should have the revenue coming in to produce it. That's a lagging right? As that's a lagging indicator when you want to bring in the person on operations side. If you're going to hire proactively before the money's there, you're probably bringing somebody in, you know, for sales or marketing.
Yeah.
Those folks are used to commissional pay, you know, commission-based payout. They're used to profit sharing. They're used to those types of opportunities. So it's not uncommon, and you'll find people that are willing to take the risks because they're truly entrepreneurs. Their risk profile is just a bit higher.
We're speaking with Casey Clark of Cultivate Advisors. They've got a conference coming up in town. We've got more questions. If you have a question, 312-981-7200. Let's take a quick break for the news right after this on 720 WGN. Why don't you just meet me in the middle? I'm losing my mind just a little. Matt Babal here with you for a few more minutes on 720 WGN. We've got Orion Samuelson coming up with the morning show here in just a little bit. In studio with us right now is Casey Clark from Cultivate Advisors and his lovely wife, Emily, who is telling me off the air the best business deal he ever made was he fired a client to get a wife. Is that basically what happened?
It was the other way around, though, actually. The client said, hey, are you single? I said, yes. I really want to introduce you, you know, to my sister-in-law. And I said, okay, yes.
Yeah. So to his sister-in-law.
Yeah, to his sister-in-law.
Okay.
Yeah. And then
I think it'd be weird for a guy to say, I really want to introduce you to my sister.
Yeah, that would have been a little weird.
I just can't imagine setting somebody up with my sister.
No.
And that's how I thought you told the story at first. I thought, wow, he must have really trusted you and liked you.
And then we decided that this is probably not the right move. We probably shouldn't stay in this advising relationship. Let's just become brother-in-laws and we'll have the beer, you know, business advice conversations versus the more structured.
Right.
So I think it was a good decision.
And how long have you guys been married?
Almost a year. Our year anniversary is coming up.
Oh, you're just coming up on a year.
Yeah.
Wow.
The business has only been around for just over 4 years, right? So about a year in, I got introduced. So we've been together now for, coming up just over 3 years, actually, almost four. And then, so we've been married for about a year now.
I mean, I have to say, I love the way you look at him because you just look sort of like, I'm approving.
Don't screw this up. Don't say anything that's going to embarrass me.
Yes, he's kind of got that. I'm looking over your shoulder. Uh-huh. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Calls you out when she disagrees with what you say.
Absolutely, she will.
All right. So, Cultivate Advisors, you guys have a conference coming up, the Catapult Conference.
We do.
For clients only. But tell me what you guys provide for your clients during that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, obviously, we do one-on-one advising. That's what we do all year long, you know, with the advisor and the client that we work with, the small business owner. But, you know, 2 years ago, we had the idea. We said, we need to really bring this community together. We've got people all throughout U.S., Canada. We've got people in Europe. We've got even people in China that we work with. So we bring everybody together into Chicago once a year. We put on this really big 2.5-day conference. And there's really three core principles that are happening in this conference. One, it's a big celebration. Business owners don't get to celebrate. They're always celebrating their clients, their employees. They're celebrating their vendors. No one ever gets them the pat on the back and says, you're doing an amazing job. So transparently, we throw a huge party for them. We have an awards night. We go all out because we want to celebrate their achievements. And, you know, we're giving away these growth awards. And, you know, these companies are growing by 160, 200, 250% a year in terms of their growth. So, you know, that's a big piece of it. The other pieces of it, skill development. We do 20 different breakout sessions. We've got some really great keynotes. We've got Jason Vandenboom, CEO of Active Campaign. He's obviously a really big success story here in Chicago. He's going to come and actually speak to the group. So we bring in some people that have gone through that entrepreneurial journey prior and have really exploded and kind of hit their objectives, their vision, their dreams to share their stories. So
do you put your clients together regularly at all, like in situations or in group meetings so that they can learn from each other and what's working, what's not working?
Absolutely. Everything we do there is going to be workshop based. So definitely some training based, but it's also workshop based for peer learning. Mm-hmm. That's part of it because you have all these different industries. They can take these different models and bring them together to go, well, that worked for your business. I wonder if that can work for my business, although it's a very different industry. Yeah. The same model might work.
Yeah.
But the third element that we actually do for these folks is we give them the space to actually do business with each other. A lot of folks we work with are professional services or even just B2C consumer services. So we see so much networking, so much peer collaboration take place. You know, we launched our app just a few weeks ago and there's all these groups lined up. Everybody's chatting, you know, already doing business together and doing deals. So we kind of bring this community together to let somebody from Vancouver start to get introduced to a business owner in the similar industry in Chicago and they can collaborate. They can start moving needles where on the business. Well, although they're in the same industry, they're not competitors. They're not necessarily working with the same folks. So that's why our spread is so important and why we have to bring this, you know, North American community together. It's an absolute blast.
All right. So let me ask you a question about business. One of the tough things, I think, is figuring out the value of your services and how much you charge. And I think a lot of times that depends on the company you're working with, and are you trying to cultivate a relationship you hope will grow into more, or is it, you know, a straight just one shot thing, and how you decide what your prices are and things, and, you know, the rest of the market, how they're whatever. At a meeting earlier this week with somebody who we had pitched some business to, and they came back, changed the proposal significantly for what they wanted, which was fine.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted something they could do more quickly, et cetera, et cetera. And the price that they offered for the services was about not even half of what we had proposed to them.
Mm.
And the person I was working with and I had a discussion that we have to talk about what are we worth. You know, what's our value with these other projects we have and what we're doing and how much time this would take and et cetera, et cetera. And so we had a call talking about what they envisioned now in this revamp proposal, and then had the discussion where I said, well, just so you know, what we would charge for this is not what you've, you know, offered on this. And here's what we're looking at. And we will offer this at less than we have charged for other people because we want to grow with you. We want to be long term. But this is, you know, where we're at and what we need to do. And it got to be a very awkward phone call.
Sure.
And probably is not going to work out at all now. But
yeah.
And so you kind of look back and go, you know, we just threw away some business here possibly.
Yeah.
But at what point do you value the time we have with other projects and what we need to do versus just generating new business? How do you handle things like that in general?
It's a tough question. I mean, there's a lot of different models. The first thing I'll say is absolutely, if you're in an industry and you don't know what to charge, you need to do your market research and you need to do the R&D, right? And I'm not actually talking about research and development. I'm talking about rob and duplicate.
Okay.
Take, all right? Take what somebody else is doing if you're getting started. But if you're off the ground and you've got other revenue coming in, that's going to help you get an idea of what you're worth. I mean, there's really two schools of thought. One school of thought is I say, well, you're in this situation. Let's actually start with what do you want to profit? What does the business need to put out to make this worthwhile for you? Let's work all that backwards and let's figure out your pricing through that. And let's see if we can make it make sense in the market.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way. The second way is you do it by demand. You go, well, how much demand do I have? And that will dictate my price, meaning I'd rather take some money versus no money. And I really think it just depends on what stage of the business you're in through the entrepreneurial journey, when you might make those decisions. But in the situation you just shared, I think you did it right. In fact, you know, we always tell our client, one of the first levers we pull with a client when we meet them to help get the growth of the business, we go, it's time to raise prices. Let's talk about how to do that. It's one of the first conversations we normally have because people don't take into account all the different costs that go into the business. They look at the, you know, I'm going to get really accountant based on you, but they look at all the COGS and the cost of goods sold. They look at that really easily, but they're forgetting all those fixed and all those other costs, those direct allocated costs that are happening. Most importantly, the owner's time involved or the employee's time, you know, in pursuit of whatever objective they're trying to reach. So I guess the only piece of advice I can give is that to say, if I was in that situation, I would have had the exact same conversation. The only small difference I may have had is to come in and just go, our price is what it is, and it's because this is how good we are. I'll give you a small discount for maybe this portion of it, just so you can get a taste of working with me. But once I'm in, you're going to see how talented I am and how much less time you spend than what you'll spend with other vendors. And then you're not going to question my price again, because I will deliver. And I think it's that just unbelievable confidence that you will bring that makes people go, you know what, this person's more expensive, but I like them more. I trust them more. And that way, there's a bit more of a yin and yang to the relationship early on.
But then the key is, then you really have to deliver on that, right?
They have to have
their socks blown off and say, all right, we have to spend the money because this is worth it.
Welcome to the number one reason why a business will scale or why it won't. Are you good or are you not?
Is that the number one issue holding people back?
It really is. I mean, you've got to have a good product and a good service. You've got to be able to deliver. If you're not able to, there's no point working on the scale of the business. It won't last. It won't sustain it. You just think about it, right? You don't have the fundamentals like building a house. You got to put that foundation and that concrete to let all the framing sit on top. If that's cracking and you don't even have the service or product clear of how you're going to do it, or you don't know how to deliver it, you're going to be in trouble.
All right. If people want to work with Cultivate Advisors, somebody's got a company or is planning on starting a company, explain how it works with you guys.
Yeah.
What is the service model? And can you give me some general costs or is that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Happy to share all that. Yeah, we're a super transparent company. Again, our goal is to become partners with these owners and help them grow and scale, which is why we have so many of our clients have stayed with us since the beginning of the company started. Mm-hmm. Go to cultivateadvisors.com. That's a good place to start. Learn more about us. And you're going to take an entrepreneurial journey quiz when you're on our website. That's going to help us get an idea and you get an idea of what stage are you in. And that already helps us start to identify what advisor are we going to pair you with. So all of our advisors, they've all ran businesses in the past. That's the only folks we bring into the business. They're full-time employees with us, and they're incentivized based on how well you do and how well you grow the business. So that makes our model a little unique. Now, as far as the when you come in, we're going to offer you a free two-hour advising session. So we're a very see if you like it, see if you have you can create a bit of a good relationship with this advisor and there's a good fit. We start there, and then from there, we'll kind of build you a roadmap for the next 5 years to say, this is what I think we need to work on. Let's get started. It's a six-month program to start, and then it's month-to-month after. That way, if we're not doing our job and we're not delivering, you don't have to keep us around. We're pretty confident in that, which is why we have our model set up that way. An average person, you know, they're spending anywhere between $1,200 and $1,800 a month is what they're spending with us. Okay. So we try to keep costs down. We only work with small business. That's what we're really good at. And when I say small business, I mean $10 million or less.
So $1,200, $1,800 a month, that's a good nut, though, for a small business.
If you want to grow the business and you want to scale, the ROI is, you know, thousands of thousands of percent, actually, you know, yeah, lifetime. When you learn how to grow a business by 100, 200,000, or maybe a half a million, a million in a year, I mean, that's a small price to pay. But yeah, we want people who are committed and serious.
What is your next step down the road? So say Cultivate Advisors, you grow this, becomes a thing, and you're like, okay, what's your next dream vision of something you want to create?
Well, I will share one thing. It is growing, right? So it is there. I don't know if you're aware of their map, but we just hit number 280 on the Inc. 500 list for the fastest growing companies in the U.S. So we're super proud of that. Have to give a really, really big shout out to my team. It was a team effort. We grinded it out to get to that point. We're really excited about it. But what's long term for us? I mean, you know, right now, you know, we launched in Chicago. So we started here in Chicago. We've got an office now in Denver, and we've got an office in Vancouver. We're identifying another five or six markets we want to, you know, expand to over the next, let's call it 5 or 6 years. And I think long term, you know, really, we're structured like a law firm. So a lot of our advisors come in and we give them the opportunity to become partners of the company. That's one of the ways that we're going to grow and scale our company. And so through that, my hope really long term is to sit on the board of this company and really help support thousands and thousands of entrepreneurs.
Yeah. Cultivate Advisors, I know, Casey, but you're a serial entrepreneur. You're thinking about the next thing already. I know that. You're on Shark Tank here. So what is the next thing that you see yourself? Cultivate Advisors grows, becomes this great thing, and then your role gets reduced, all the younger people push you out.
Yeah.
Then you're going to do what?
Well, I used to think I just wanted to go golf all day, but I think I actually would get bored. I think I need to have something active. Yeah. But I think long term, I love the space of small business. I know what I'll do is we'll probably look into the network and go, what are these businesses that really have this opportunity to grow and scale? We'll go get a bigger piece in terms of coming in and really capitally investing into those businesses. That's where I see myself going long term. But right now, I'm pretty happy with where I'm at. We're making a big impact.
Casey Clark with Cultivate Advisors. Visit them at cultivateadvisors.com. Thank you to him and his lovely wife, Emily, and baby Matthew.
I don't think that name's on the list.
We can add it to the
That's going
to
float in there, though, now. You'll remember how you started out your birthday morning. That Matt guy, that was a really nice guy. I think Matthew, that really sounds good, Casey. I think we should think about Matthew. Just going to just let that marinate a little bit. All right, guys, thank you so much for coming in. Have a wonderful birthday.
Thank you, Matt.
And we look forward to seeing more from Cultivate Advisors, cultivateadvisors.com. News coming up in a little bit here on 720 WGN.
Closing time. One last call for alcohol, so finish your whiskey or beer.
Thanks, everybody, for hanging out with us this morning. We really appreciate it. 720 WGN. Thanks again to Casey Clark and Cultivate Advisors, cultivateadvisors.com. 708 texts, many small businesses have such limited hours. You can't survive working 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. But I wonder, though, when you see businesses like that, and I've talked about this. I have a friend, Grant, who was in recently with the guys that own the Rookies and the Village Squire restaurants. And we're talking about these breakfast places that are just open 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And I was like, I don't understand. They're paying rent on all that time. Why? And he said, cost of goods, cost of services, cost of everything else. You just weigh that. And I imagine with a lot of these small businesses that are 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., it's, you know, earlier than that, not enough people come in to support the man hours that you have people working, or later than that. And that all gets weighed into how the businesses work if they're doing it well.
I've seen over the decades what you might call greasy spoons.
Sure.
Little eateries.
Diners.
Diners that are only open for breakfast.
There's, you know what, that is all the rage out in the burbs right now, Roger.
Oh, really?
And even down here, there's places called Yoke and Experience. Mm-hmm. And out by us, there's a great place called Benedict's and a great place called Burnt Toast mm-hmm. that have a few, and they're 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And I'm always, there's one that we go to quite a bit, and I talk to the manager. I'm like, dinner, just open one night a month for dinner. I swear you'll kill it here. Because there's so many times, like, man, I wish there was a great place to go to for pancakes.
Sure.
Or something for dinner. I mm-hmm. think breakfast for dinner is delicious.
But again, if they're in a location where there are a lot of people because they're working there, or there are a lot of people during those hours that are there because sure. of yes. they're shopping there or whatever, that's their clientele. They're probably in a location where people are not going to drive to there, for dinner or early breakfast.
Some of these restaurants are in areas that have all... So the Burnt Toast place that mm-hmm. I love, mm-hmm. right next to it is Village Square Pizza, Sushi Station, Rookies... Panera, Starbucks, there are all sorts of places that are open all day long.
Mm-hmm.
They could do a killing at least once a month. But I imagine they're like, you know, there's just not enough demand, so they don't do it. But,
yeah.
man, I think they could do something awfully good with that.
Well, you know what that means. You have to open your own place.
We'll have to bring Casey in and see if he can help us do that.
You're going to have to forego your condo at the Trib Tower and open up your own place.
Oh, man. But if I open up that old place, maybe we make enough money to get that condo at the Tribune Tower. That's
see?
How we got to think
positive
about
thinking.
All right. Speaking of great entrepreneurial minds, Orion Samuelson coming up next here on 720 WGN. Again, everybody, so much for being with us this weekend. I will be off next weekend as away in Nebraska visiting Jack and his friends out there and seeing the Ohio State Buckeyes come into town to take on Nebraska. Joining us right now, live on the air, is Orion Samuelson. Good morning, Big O.
Well, good morning to you. I've experienced my first cold of 2019, and you can probably hear it in my voice. Generally, I get laryngitis about once a year. Don't have laryngitis yet, but I caught cold in time for fall.
Oh, boy. And the weather hasn't even turned yet, oh?
I know it, and you're heading for Nebraska.
I am next weekend, yes. You know what? I haven't really talked to you about this yet, but our oldest son, Jack, is off at the University of Nebraska. So
right.
Colleen and I and the kids have been to Lincoln a couple times. The nicest people in the world. I mean, I have fallen in love with that city.
Well, I have, too, because I've been out there many times at the university, and Clayton Neider, who was our Secretary of Agriculture at one point, has sort of... started out there, so had the opportunity to get out, visit the campus at the University of Nebraska, and I think your son has picked a good school.
I think he has, too. What do you have coming up on your show today, sir?
Well, as usual, Jim Fazell, and an important subject, because we're at the end of the growing season. What do you do with the pesticides, the insecticides, and everything else as we go into the winter? He'll have a lot of good advice for you on that. And we'll talk markets with Jerry Gulkey of the Gulkey Group here in Chicago.
That sounds good. You rest up, feel much better, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Okay. Have a good trip.
All right, Orion. Thank you so much. Chicago Stories told 24/7 on 720 WGN Chicago.